UFC going back to Singapore this weekend. Holloway take you on the Korean Zombie on the marquee. A lot of fights to go over here with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. And just like that, we're back and we're looking forward to another big weekend in MMA. As always, one half of your hosting duo, Craig Allen, Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, as always, respective socials at Matt Allen FNP. A big time weekend coming off of UFC 292 with Fight Night Picks. Listen, you raise a trophy up, you enjoy it, and at the end of the year, we get to figure out who the prediction MVP is. Matt, of course, getting the trophy.
Didn't make as many excuses as last year,
but when we do look at this one, it was a three-peat before that one. When we do look at this one, Matt, featherweights in the marquee, Max Holloway taking on the Korean Zombie, who has had 9 straight main events in a row, and for the Korean Zombie, a long time away since his title bid against Alexander Volkanovski back in 2022, Max Holloway's last time turned out a big time performance. It turned away the young challenger being Arnold Allen. But when you look at a card like this, a co-main event, it's a rematch of a fight we got in 2021 in a main event. That's Anthony Smith taking on Ryan Spann. We also have what was supposed to be a main event earlier on this year in Tyler Santos taking on Aaron Blanchfield. Blanchfield with the second round finish over Andrade. Santos has been on the sidelines for quite a while. A lot of big time returns on this card as well. Not just Korean Zombie, not just Tyler Santos, but as well Giga Chikadze. He's going to be taking on Alex Caceres. 7 sophomore showings on this card, so the research had to be a little bit crazy, and 1 rookie debut, and it's Billy Goff. So a lot of stuff to look forward to, but this is one of those cards where fans recognize the top names, but they might not recognize a lot of the prospects on the card.
I think this is a surprisingly good Fight Night card, though, because like you said, there's 4 legitimate fights that could all headline their own Fight Night card. Anthony Smith has been the main event how many times? Him versus Ryan Spann could easily be a Fight Night main event. Of course, you've got Holloway versus Zombie at the top of the card, but also Chikadze versus Caceres, that could probably be a main event, especially judging where Chikadze is at this stage of his career, just to go along with Aaron Blanchfield versus Tyler Santos. So some of the top tier names on this card have really important fights ahead of them.
8 main events for Anthony Smith and 1 co-main event in his long UFC career. Some big time fights in this one. It should be noted as a programming note, this card's going to be very, very early for the North American audiences. It takes place Saturday morning for us here on the East Coast. So make sure you check out things well in advance for question mark kicks. We'll throw that one out there on the socials, so you know when we're going to be going live. It most likely will be Friday night, but I get home late Friday night. So we'll see what happens. You can always find us at Fight Night Picks. Craig Allen FNP, Matt Allen FNP. A lot of fights to talk about. You're not going to want to miss any of it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
And it's featherweights on the poster and featherweights to kick off this card. Coming up this weekend, we have Korean Zombie MMA teammate. It is Sting Sungmoo Choi taking on the Dutch kickboxer who has a little bit of judo in his back pocket. I'm talking about Jarno Arens. And this is a fight that I'm oddly excited about, because for Sungmoo Choi, he only does have 1 bonus in his UFC career, and he has lost his last 3 fights. It does feel like a tale of 2 different fights for both of these competitors, because for Choi, it's a chance to get back on the horse, to get back in the win column, and if he loses 4 in a row, that could be it. He seems like one of those fighters, like a Gregory Rodriguez that we had last weekend, where the talents, there are plenty, the chin, it stays out there in the wind quite a bit, and for Choi, his last 3 fights, their losses, 2 of those 3 are by finish. He goes out there, he cracks Alex Caceres, drops him, and then in the scramble, Caceres gets a submission win. Choi goes out there against Joshua Kulibao, gets officially dropped twice. I counted 3, if not 4. And then Choi's last time out, the double knockdown, like it's Dale Doback and Brendan Huff and Step Brothers with a baseball bat and a golf club. Choi gets cracked again, and then he gets cracked a 3rd time. They credited Trezano with 2 knockdowns. They decided that that wasn't good enough. Mike Trezano, happy trails. We don't need you in the UFC. I saw 3, but for Sungmoo Choi, he's in that JP Bays category of getting knocked down in some of these fights. If he's taking on a better grappler, he can struggle in some of the spots, like Evloev on about a month's notice in the debut, or Gavin Tucker. But where I do like Sungmoo Choi is he's really well-rounded, but it seems like he sees red. He bites down on the mouthpiece, and Daniel Cormier even called him out in some of his recent fights. He leads with his head and kind of closes his eye in the blitzes. eyes in the blitzes, and he gets hit quite a bit. And against Jarno Ahrens, who's got a lot of power, we've seen it with the uppercut up the middle, we've seen it with some of his hooks and his kicks. It could get Choi caught, but now he's automatically going away from even the top 30, and he's taking on an Ahrens who had a competitive fight in his debut against William Gomez, but he's still in that very much like an introductory stage to his career.
I've said this about Michael Olushayczyk, and don't worry, we're going to get to that fighter in just a bit, but he's one of these fighters who, if I just tell you all the positives, you're probably going to assume he's a top 5, top 10 fighter in the division, and then if I start to trickle out some of the weaknesses, it paints the fuller picture. And for Sungmoo Choi, he's a bit in that category. If you just want to talk about the positives that he can bring into the cage, well, he's huge for the weight class. He does do a good job at closing the distance when he is able to do it effectively. But like you mentioned, there is kind of always that by the way with his skill set. And I would take it a little step further than even just the durability issues. Because like you said, when he's the better grappler, he can have success on the mat. But the problem is, if I see you get hurt on the feet, if I see you get out grappled, it does lead me to wonder, okay, what kind of an opponent is tailor-made for you to go out there and beat? And for Jarno Ahrens, I think Sungmoo Choi has the more mixed martial arts skills in his toolbox, but he could walk into a big shot and completely change the complexion of this fight. And that's why it's always been difficult breaking down a Sungmoo Choi fight, because if you just look at his skill set, he's better than a 10-6 fighter. And I know he's fought pretty good fighters in the UFC too, but again, if you just look at all the positives he brings into the cage, they are very numerous, but at this stage of his career where we've seen him get hit, we've seen him get controlled, I do worry about, again, if you gave Sungmoo Choi a game plan and you say, okay, how is the exact method you want to go out there and beat Jarno Ahrens? I'd be curious to see what his answer is. Would he decide to strike a little bit on the outside, even though, of course, that could probably lead to his doom? Or will he go for a lot more of the wrestling? Because it is one of those double-edged swords for him, and I don't think he's going to be on the receiving end of a ton of traditional takedowns in this matchup, but I would like to see him at least go to that well a little bit more. Because, again, if he's just a sitting duck on the outside, Ahrens throws with so much more heat and speed with his own shots that I do worry about the overall durability of Wu Choi.
Jarno Ahrens is one of those guys. Again, he's got a judo brown belt. His parents had a judo school, so he grew up in that environment. We've had a lot of fighters come into the UFC recently who have had that lineage. You think of Michael Morales, his parents are both into the mixed martial arts. Omar Morales' dad and karate started Slam, his own mixed martial arts. So for Jarno Ahrens, he has that judo in his back pocket. He gets the kickboxing done, and really his kicks set up his boxing. And that's one of the weird things. Ahrens will kind of go to the kicks to throw it and melt things into his combinations, but then at points he'll just decide to box. And in his fight against Max Koga, you see him go out there with the jab and then throw the uppercut. He knocks him down, he knocks him dead, and throws like a, it was almost like a Dan Henderson H-bomb. Like, he's just jumping in there and landing on top. But with Ahrens, he makes that debut against William Gomez. And I listened to an interview that Jarno Ahrens did recently with Sensei Sam. And it was interesting because they were out there kicking the mitts and then they're sitting in the gym and talking to one another. And he said that he cut 12 kilograms for that fight against
it's
William Gomez. He went from 78 to 66 kgs on short notice. He also said that, you know, the fight he was supposed to have against David Onama that was going to be earlier on this year, that one fell out because he had a shoulder injury. He also has his own video series out there, kind of like we saw it out of the fight before Sean Strickland took on his last opponent, Abus Magomedov. This guy's out there doing his own production, doing his own road too. Well, Jarno Ahrens is doing that like Magomedov was. And for Ahrens, a couple of weeks ago, so who really knows how long ago they filmed it, but he was working his way through an ankle injury. He said it's been kind of tough to deal with, but it's been a part of the camp. So Ahrens with the ankle injury, earlier on the shoulder injury, but you go back and you watch his fights. His takedown defense is bad. It's straight up bad. I watched his fight at Brave CF 61. It was a cross promotion where Ahrens was the NFC champ at one point. And Brave does a lot of cross promotion like that. They do it with Octagon, spelled with a C, not K, the big Octagon. But Ahrens in that fight against Abdullayev, he gets taken down in the first round. He gets taken down in the third round. Third round, he's able to reverse it and get into some advantageous grappling positions. And in the second round, he was able to land one of those Koshi Gurumas, just like old Gregory Rodriguez will land. But for Ahrens, again, the striking's where it gets done. The takedown defense is bad, and I could see him being at a size disadvantage, even though both these guys are pretty, they're both pretty big featherweights in this one. Ultimately, again, I think Sungmoo Choi is better than your average 10-6 UFC fighter on a three-fight skid. The odds suggest that because Choi is a 2-1 favorite in this one. We have a look at the topology votes. Matt, surprised that's there to you. I'm going to say over under 75% Choi in this one.
I was thinking 65, so I'll say under.
I'm going to say under. It's slightly under. So 652 total votes, 72% Choi, 76% by decision for the 28% that have Ahrens, 62% by decision. I think the biggest point I can make on Choi as far as odds and fan votes are concerned. Choi, out of all of the losses, Caceres, Kulibao, and then his last time out against Mike Trezano. 78% of the fans on Tapology, 85%, 82% have picked him to win in those fights. He has been favored in multiple fights, all but the Evloev fight, the Tucker fight, and the fight against Yusuf Salal in the UFC. So more often than not, Sungmoo Choi is a favorite. He's usually a pretty big favorite too, and he's lost in those big stages. That could happen this weekend, but who do you have in the pick here?
Any more negative things to say about the man? I do have Sungmoo Choi in this matchup. Again, I was going into this fight in this prediction video kind of assuming I wasn't going to pick him just because of how poor his last few performances have been. But the thing about Charno is, it's not just the takedown defense. He lets guys get to his hips. Even if they don't secure that takedown attempt, it's still wasting time and at least putting out some of the fire he's able to do on the outside with his own strikes. So if Sungmoo Choi can slow this fight down, not fight at the pace of Charno, and not hesitate when he does initiate a lot of these exchanges, because if Sungmoo Choi does find himself kind of clenching up and moving out shin first, that's when normally things start to go poorly for him. So I do have Sungmoo Choi, but if he loses this one, like, I don't know what they do with a 10-7 featherweight at this division.
They cut the f*** out of him. Why would they keep a 10-7 featherweight on a 4-fight losing streak?
I know, Craig. That's why I said I don't know what they're going to do with him.
You do know.
Yeah, they're going to cut him, Craig.
They're going to cut him. I have Sungmoo Choi in the matchup. I think he's going to be able to cut some of that distance against Aarons. And we saw a good counter striker in William Gomez have success in the offensive wrestling the last time out. I know one of the judges scored it 29-29, and that's why it's a draw. He scored the last round as a 10-10. I thought Aarons had a little bit of a case round two, round three with the damage in the shots versus some of the pot shots and the grappling of Gomez. That's neither here nor there. So in this matchup, both of us going with Sungmoo Choi, but for Jarno, Aaron's complete skill set except for the takedown defense. We'll see how it plays out for him in this one. And again, as I said to open it, featherweight in the marquee, Max Holloway taking on Korean Zombie in the main event. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
People out there in the comments section, they might call us out for this one. They might not be a fan of this one, but I'm going to start it off by asking you this question. Why is this fight a thing? Coming up this weekend at flyweight, we have Liang Na, who hasn't won a fight since 2021 when she was 18-4 and beat a debuting fighter to get into the UFC. Liang Na finished in her debut against Ariane Carnelosi, finished in the first round against Silvana Gomez-Juarez her last time out, and now Liang Na moving up a weight class. And she has fought at flyweight in the past, taking on the former Ultimate Fighter Season 23 alum and actual UFC women's flyweight. We have JJ Aldrich. And Matt, I say that because in this one, I mean, for Liang Na, her first strike against Ariane Carnelosi was a right cross that drops Carnelosi backwards. She looks like she's going to have a lot of success in some of the grappling exchanges. And then Liang Na just kind of burn out. And at the end of the first round, her coach, Song Yadong, had to walk in, pick Liang Na up off the ground, bring her to the stool. She looked completely gassed out. She comes out for the second. She gets beat. Her last time out against Silvana Gomez-Juarez, she goes for one of those kind of long cross-cage ankle picks that you'll see out of Liang Na. She's unable to get it. La Malvada hitting her like she's Johnny Walker against Paul Craig. And then, of course, it is a Silvana Gomez-Juarez two-punch combo. That's it, folks. You don't see a lot of walk-off knockouts, but that was one of them. So for Liang Na, moving up to 125, she takes on JJ Aldrich out of Elevation Fight Team, somebody who traditionally has had good takedown defense in her UFC run. She had a couple of really tidy wins in her last five fights, but her last time out, Aldrich, all three judges scored at 30-27 for Ariane Lipsky, and we thought, hey, Aldrich is a good striker on the outside. Her second to last fight was a loss to Erin Blanchfield, who's on this card, but Aldrich won that first round with her striking, ultimately standing finish for Blanchfield. But for Aldrich, it just seemed like a flat performance her last time out, and maybe it was a one-off, and maybe that's a sign of things to come. But when you look at a fight like this, for Aldrich being able to defend some takedowns, she also has the fact that in her back pocket, a win over Jillian Robertson, one of the better grapplers, the best submission grappler we've ever seen in women's flyweight history. By numbers only. But when you do look at a matchup like this, I question why this is even a thing. That's very harsh.
I gotta be honest. Well, you could say that about five fights on every single card for the most part, so I don't really feel the need to single this one out. JJ Aldrich always fights in pretty much the exact same way, though. And that's the thing. She's gonna use her boxing. She's gonna squat down a lot, use her hands, try to force the engagements because she does do a good job on the inside, has decent power from both hands. The thing about Aldrich is she's one of those fighters who, if she had like 15% more power to her game, she would be not unstoppable. That's a step too far. But she would be that much more effective because she is able to throw damaging shots when she's able to connect connect in combination, but they're not heavy like a Jessica Andrade or even like an Amanda Lemos. Probably not the greatest name to bring up after last night, but Aldridge, for the most part, is going to try to defend your takedowns, maybe shoot for one of her own every now and then up against the cage. It does help her boxing when she is able to at least threaten with that second move, but what is she good at? She's pretty steady throughout 15 minutes, and I really do think that's going to be the biggest X factor for this matchup. If Liang Na does have improved cardio, maybe even improved durability up at this weight class, then maybe she will be able to extend her game to make it more competitive as it goes on late. But for Aldridge, if she can just keep the jab in Na's face, use a power shot every now and then, I do think on the outside, she has the complete amount of skills that you need to win this matchup. And JJ Aldridge was a fighter who I thought was going to make a leap, kind of add more things to her game. But for the most part, she's just kind of steady. You can just trust her to do what she does. And that's a lot of forward pressure, a lot of boxing. But the thing was, that last matchup, we did see her struggle on the back foot, especially at range. And I do wonder if she is ever going to add sort of those long to middle range techniques in her game, because the kicks aren't nearly as effective as the punches are.
Well, and if you go over to JJ Aldrich's Instagram in the last couple of weeks, training Colorado with Hype or Die, Matt's favorite coach, you know who HD is, one of the best nicknames in all of MMA.
It's been a long day, I don't.
Pat Barry, Matt. JJ Aldrich throwing the kicks to the pads. And when you do look at a fight like this for Liang Na, she has 19 wins and 6 losses. 18 of 19 wins are big time early finishes in the first round. All of her wins are by finish, and 18 of them are in the first round. You saw what happened in the second round when she took on Ariane Carnelosi. If she fights at that high of a pace, it tends to burn quick.
Be a fun fight, though.
It's all over. So we'll see how this one goes. Again, for Aldrich, a massive favorite in this one. We'll have a look at the topology vote. Surprised us there to you.
This one, I have to say, though, I'm a little surprised that Aldrich is such a big favorite, just because normally you have a fighter at least coming off a win or two in a position like that, being a minus 650.
That is fair. We have a look at the topology vote. Surprised us there to you. I'm going to say over under 97% JJ Aldrich.
Doesn't leave me a lot of wiggle room, so I'll say under.
You're going to say under, and it is, whoa, it's under. 748 total votes, 84% Aldrich, 87% by decision. For the 16% that have Liang Na, 26% by submission, 54% by decision. Matt, Liang Na has won 19 fights. None of them have gone to a decision, and I don't think she's winning a decision this weekend either.
It's tough to finish someone like Aldrich unless you do have that kind of X-factor skill set in your back pocket. If you are a one-of-one power puncher, if you do have very good submissions on the mat, then yes, you can get over some of those hurdles, but for the most part, the steadiness is something that I think Liang Na is really going to struggle with, and for that reason, I've got Aldrich.
JJ Aldrich doesn't lead herself all the way into the pocket all that often. That's what Carnelosi did. Ran across the cage, ate her right hand, backed right off, and then we get into an absolutely wild fight to kick off the prelims of a pay-per-view card, and that really did get it going. But when I look at a fight like this, I like the steadiness out of Aldrich. I think the last fight was her Bruno Silva Gerald Meerschaert, so I'll attribute it to that, and I'll go with Aldrich in this fight. Always tough when you take on a specialist like Liang Na. She likes the body lock, she likes the trip takedown, she is a tricky fighter in that respect, but we'll see how this one plays out, and both of us going with Denver's own JJ Aldrich. Some big time fights in this card, including the next one between the debuting Billy Goff taking on Yusaku Kinoshita. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Any welcome to the UFC, to Dana White's Contender Series 2022 contract winner, the former CEF's welterweight, and then a few weeks later, middleweight champ. It is Billy Goff, set to make that debut against the top prospect out of Japan, Yusaku Kinoshita. And Matt, going back and watching the tape for both of these guys, now I'm super locked and in for this one. Because for Billy Goff, it's all offense and very little defense. For Yusaku Kinoshita, the same can be said. And when you watch both of these guys, defensively, the grappling, it's not the best. Offensively, it's really good. So they match up incredibly well together. And I started this off by saying the top prospect, Yusaku Kinoshita, went into his last fight, debut against Adam Fugate. We threw up every red flag that we could. And Kinoshita is able to go out there and land some good shots, but he ends up getting dropped by Fugate. He gets grappled by Fugate, and then it ends with those elbows down against the mat. So for Kinoshita, a guy who trained for the very longest time out of his native Japan, a former Pancrase man, he switched it up, and his last camp was at Killcliff FC. This camp is also at Killcliff FC, so we'll see what things Kinoshita has been able to add to his tool belt, because this week, He just turns 23. So really, really impressive young fighter, as is Billy Goff, who just turned 25 not that long ago. And for Goff, as I said, he ends up on Contender Series. He gets dropped early by Shimon Smetritsky. He has a giant wild comeback, and I counted over 30 punches unanswered in that combo. And that's the crazy part about Billy Goff's game. You go back even to his welterweight title fight against Gary Belletto Jr. with CES. It's the same thing. It's kind of drawn out, and then it's Billy Goff going body head for about a 30-punch combination. He gets the win. His last time out with CES, it was for the middleweight belt. About 28 days later against, it was Dana White's Contender Series vet, Justin Sumter. He gets beaten early in that one, only to rally back in it. He gets dropped early in certain fights. He rallies back. And I listened to an interview that Billy Goff did with Jake Noker of The Scrap just before our pay-per-view card of UFC 292. And Billy Goff had said, for the last five fights, including Contender Series, I had a torn meniscus in my left knee, and it didn't feel great, but it was never really an issue. So he ended up tearing his other meniscus, getting ready for the fight against Themba Garimbo. If you go to his Tapology page, you'll see that Billy Goff was supposed to fight earlier on this year. So he had multiple meniscus tears, and he got double knee surgery. It kept him out of action for a couple of months. He was able to train, or at least coach wrestling in that time off. But Goff, back, looking to be better than ever, taking on Kinoshita in this one. I think it's an awesome fight.
Is Kinoshita going to become Dante Exum, though? That's what I can't get out of my mind, because I was so excited for him to make his debut against Fugate, and I'll be the first one to admit, I got that fight completely wrong. I also said Sean O'Malley was going to be like Damian Lillard and go home without a title, but guess what? Every now and then, you got to raise your hand and take an L. But I didn't like the way he faced adversity in that matchup, and I know he got dropped early, but once Fugate was on top of him landing that ground and pound, there wasn't that second burst out of Kinoshita, and it's not just the fact that he was getting held down, it just... like, there wasn't moving off your back. There wasn't threatening, trying to get your guard back. Like, remember Michael Bisping got taken down by GSP over and over again? He would get his guard back, so it's a much safer position. Then he would respond with his own ground and pound. I'm not saying every fighter needs to do that, but those are the types of things you want to see a fighter work out of and at least have some success in those areas. And I do worry a little bit about, hey, if Billy Goff's the one who starts landing the initial shots, if he doesn't have to be on the receiving end of a big knockdown and then kind of come back into the fight, then what are we going to see out of Kinoshita? Does he have that second level to his game of, okay, I get hurt, and now when the going gets tough, I'm going to get tough as a result? Because we've seen it out of Billy. Like, you've referenced all of his fights. I went back and watched the majority of them too, and it is kind of wild how the majority follow the exact same script. It's he gets hurt, gets clocked, gets dropped, stunned, however you want to call it, and then gets his way back into the fight, which is an admirable thing to be able to show matchup in, matchup out. But in the same breath, you do also have to worry, okay, if he does get hit by a big shot from a guy like Kinoshita, is he even going to be there to respond afterwards? Because Kinoshita does have absurd power, even though we weren't necessarily able to see it in the last matchup. If you go back and watch his tape on the regional scene, this guy has legitimate pop.
For Kinoshita, I mean, 5 first round finishes out of 6 total wins. On Dana White's Contender Series, he fought Jose Henrique, who was a big prospect out of Novo Nyao. They signed him back in June. Kid pissed hot. USADA, 2-year suspension. See you later, bud. So for Yusaku in that fight, he's fighting a really tall fighter. Nobody knew if Henrique was going to be 6'3 or 6'5 or whatever the hell he was. But Kinoshita played the long game on the outside. And if you like the Sean O'Malley win over Aljamain Sterling, go back and watch Kinoshita when he took on Jose Henrique, because they were saying, hey, just like Conor McGregor, southpaw, pullback, counter, and that's all she wrote. And for Kinoshita, you go back and you watch him on the regional scene. The one loss that he had before the Fugate fight was one where he completely blitzed his opponent. He drops him with, with a punch. His opponent's down. He lands a soccer kick. Then he grabs the cage and starts stomping the guy's face in. The stomps were legal. The soccer kick was legal. The fence grabs were not. So he ends up losing the fight by disqualification. But you go back and you watch Kinoshita. You could see that he struggled against some of the takedowns, but he was able to get himself out of those bad positions. You even saw fights where he'd drop an opponent, they'd want to try and play jiu-jitsu with him, and he could utilize really good ground and pound in the interim. Go ahead.
I just worry about what happens when he's the one getting dropped and he's the one who has to fight out of the poor position. That's all. Again, when you're the one getting the takedowns and you're showing great grappling from the top spot, how many fighters do we talk about every single week where it's, hey, they have great offensive wrestling and good offensive grappling, but when they're on the receiving end of those exact same techniques, they just don't have the same skills.
So both guys with long plane rides to get over to Singapore. Kinoshita out of Florida for Billy Goff out of Connecticut. You have a look at this one, Matt. Odds are pretty darn close. Kinoshita was a minus 350 against Fugate. He's a Bota minus 150 at this point. We have a look at the Tapology votes. Has everyone sold their stock? We're going to find out. I'm going to say over under 67.5% Kinoshita in this one.
I think it's going to be over.
I think it's going to be over. And it's the opposite. 720 total votes, 73% Goff, 81% by knockout for the 27% that have Kinoshita, 62% by knockout. So the fans think there's going to be a knockout, and the fans have the underdog in this fight. And Billy Goff, who do you have?
I believed in Dante Exum until about a year ago. That man hasn't played in the NBA since about 2019, so it takes me a little while to get off some of these trains. I am going to pick Kinoshita. I do think he showed me enough on the regional scene that, again, if he's able to hit Billy Goff, especially on his way in, it'll accentuate his own power that much more, and I do think he does have enough pop in his shots to go out there and get the win, but again, I can't raise enough red flags after what I saw in the last matchup, and by me being so high on him, so I'm not going to sell all of my stock. I do still have him in this matchup, but this can be a great and competitive fight.
Yusaku's an interesting guy with all those first-round finishes. Being a young fighter, you're not coupling him in the Raul Rosas Jr. category just yet, but we don't know what the cardio looks like as fights go on. We did see three rounds of it against Henrique, and we saw a finish at the end, but what we saw out of Kinoshita on those regional scene fights, other than dropping just about every one of his opponents, was if he's able to drop them or if he's looking to defend a takedown, he can usually try and sweep, he can grab a front choke, that's a big part of his game, an anaconda or a guillotine. And against a guy like Billy Goff, who he's just there, he's with that lasting power, he continues to pressure forward. The thing where I see Kinoshita shining is the fact that he's a southpaw and he throws a big body kick and a big head kick, and Billy Goff has a low right hand as an orthodox fighter, even though Goff will switch his stances. I'm gonna go with Billy Goff in this fight. I think it's a little bit against my better judgment. For me, the more I watched the tape, the more I saw this guy can withstand just about everything and continue to throw with a lot of volume and a lot of power. Kinoshita tends to drop his hands as the fight goes on, and so I like Goff in this one. Matt going with the Japanese super prospect Kinoshita. You let us down below. Let us know who you have. We have some big-time fights on this card, including a rematch of a main event up near the top. Anthony Smith taking on Ryan Spann. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. Couple of welterweight finishers squaring up in Kaolang with 33 wins between them and 24 finishes. It is Song Kanon, the assassin, taking on the machine, Rolando Bedoya, who came in, made his UFC debut. It was a split decision loss against Chaos Williams, a guy who at that time had a tidy UFC record and a big, big lineage behind him. Bedoya goes out there, made it really competitive, had great volume throughout all three rounds, and now he gets to take on a really tough fighter out of Killcliff FC in Song Kanon. And there's a lot of Killcliff fighters on this card, Yusaku, Kinoshita, and Song Kanon among them. But when you look at a fight like this, I know a lot of people are really, really excited to see that Bedoya debut. Bedoya is one of those guys, 14-1, trains at a premier gym. Charles Oliveira, Daniel Santos is also on this card. And was Rolando Bedoya in that infamous sauna scene picture over in Fight Island? You bet your ass he had that blonde hair sweating it out with the boys. He's there for the team. He's a ride or die. But when you look at a guy like Bedoya, Matt, this is where it gets a little weird. So 14-1, 7 wins by decision, 7 wins by finish. The average, or at least the combined opponent record, 57-29. That's good.
It is.
Weighted by the last two wins. I mean, he had a win over a 17-6 Otalara, whose best win was a 9-2 fighter who had only beaten two winning fighters. See, when you dive into the weeds, it gets a little chintzy. The other win that he has over 10-1 fighter in Dorta, who's a former featherweight. So it's a little weird that way. Then you go back through and you watch these Bedoya fights. They're easy to find. They're out there on YouTube with FFC and some other promotions. I mean, beating Enrique Granados Ferreira, who was 8-4, beating Washington Nunes, who was 7-4 back, almost 4 years ago, and then Otalara and then Dorta. If you go back and watch those fights, Bedoya holds his hands at about chest height, and I have it written in big letters, good chin, gets hit a lot.
That's the problem. Do you want to be known for having a good chin when you fight Chaos Williams? Like, is that what your coaches are telling you? Hey, we're fighting Chaos Williams. We want you to show off that good chin. No, nobody would ever say that in the history of ever. That's why, again, to open this, I really wanted to stress, when Williams is off, let's say, when he's not fighting at his peak, the hands are at least still up. The defense is still somewhat sound. Whereas for Bedoya, it's still him getting hit by clean shots, and that's the big differentiator between these two.
Yeah, I mean, going back and watching Bedoya, like, he throws throws a really good leg kick. He'll switch stance. He'll throw it to the body. He'll throw it to the head. I love three-level kickers. He has that resolve to bite down on the mouthpiece. Instead of biting down on the mouthpiece, he smiles big time and drops his hands more when he gets hit and invites the brawl. So then the fighters push him up against the cage, and then he can work in some different areas of his game, because he is a very well-rounded mixed martial artist, is a guy like Bedoya. And in that fight, Derek Cleary scoring that fight, a 30-27 for Bedoya. And I mean, for me, I actually had a 29-28 Bedoya, and I'd like to get your thoughts on the rewatch, but a 30-27 wasn't totally out of the question. Everybody was split on MMA decisions. There were 8 that had it for Williams and 7 that had it for Bedoya, but an ultra-competitive fight against the guy who at that point had a 4-2 UFC record.
And all the rounds were close, too. It was one of those fights where, again, I don't really care how you scored it. 29-28 Williams, 29-28 Bedoya. That's how close the rounds really were, and you bring it up, and that was the most surprising thing. Not only was it nice to see the volume out of Bedoya to kind of meet Chaos Williams is one detriment with his own success, but he was pretty comfortable standing in the pocket with a guy that we have seen send people to the land of wind and ghost, to quote Luke Thomas. But I'm going to be
the
really
Simpsons.
Luke Thomas says it all the time, though. For Orlando Bedoya, I was really impressed in that Chaos Williams performance, because Chaos is one of those guys who, yes, on his best day can look really good. We've seen all the crazy power. But for Bedoya to just be in his face so consistently throughout that matchup, that's a position that not a lot of ranked welterweights probably want to find themselves staring down Chaos Williams. So for Bedoya, whether you thought he won or lost his UFC debut, it was one of those fights where he gained stock no matter what the result was. And I like this as kind of a sophomore outing for him in this matchup, because Song Kinnan's a guy who was probably watching last weekend's pay-per-view, like that Leonardo DiCaprio meme watching Neil Magny versus Ian Garry, because let's be honest, Song Kinnan looked better against Ian Garry than Neil Magny did. Neil Magny ate a bunch of leg kicks and backed up the whole time. Song was actually able to meet some of Ian Garry's power with his own, had a great knockdown early on in that matchup, and was doing well on the outside, but eventually Garry was able to close the distance and land his own power shots. But for Song Kinnan, he's another one of these guys who, if you just want to talk about a skill set, the guy is extremely skilled in most areas of MMA, but I'll be very curious to see if his power can shine through some of that volume of Bedoya.
Song Kinnan's career is wild. He was able to rock and roll against Brad Riddell, and he was winning early until he lost it late. He was able to drop Ian Garry with the left hook, follow it up, and look amazing in the first round, only for Ian Garry to rally back round 2 and round 3 and win that fight and get a finish. Kinnan is one of those guys where he's 4-3 in the UFC, so that shines, but out of the 4 wins, combine those 4 guys' UFC records together, it's 1-10. Callum Potter was the only one to get a UFC win, and it was an impressive one, but poor Judo Dan had to watch his boy out there lose to Song Kinnan. So if you do look at it for Song Kinnan, it's been a slow burn, he's been inactive, and now he's looking to kind of get that ball rolling once more against one of these big-time prospects. And for Rolando Bedoya, we already mentioned it, but shoot the box through and through. Maybe he was able to train a little bit with Ian Garry to get ready for a fight like this, because Garry did spend most of his last training camp in Brazil. You look at the odds in the matchup, Bedoya is a pretty darn big favorite in this one. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. For me, the Bedoya fight against Williams feels like Diego Lopez taking on Movsar Evloev. You gain a hell of a lot of stock in a loss like that. I think the fans like him here. I'm going to say over under 80% Bedoya.
I think it'll be under 80, but it'll be the favorite.
It's over 80, 727 total votes, 86% Bedoya, 63% by decision, 28% by knockout. For the 14% that have Song Kinnan, 50% by decision, 41% by knockout. And it does scare you when a young guy decides to stand in the pocket with power strikers, and every time he gets hit, he starts smiling like he's Fabricio Verdum. But I do like Orlando Bedoya in this matchup, and I think the volume and the power can kind of carry him far in a fight like this.
And I think he's going to overwhelm Song Kinnan, especially if he does back him up behind those 2 black lines, because Song does have a very high posture defensively, especially when he is on the back foot. And not that Bedoya needs to throw power like a Chaos Williams in this matchup, but if you just throw enough dartboards at the board, or darts at the board, guess what? You're going to hit a bullseye eventually. And I do think his sheer volume, maybe not get the knockout win, but can at least go out there and win rounds against Song Kinnan, because that is the one part of Song's game that I don't enjoy whatsoever. When he's backing up, he is much less responsible than when he's the one moving forward, and I think Bedoya is going to be able to use those terms and dictate this fight.
The volume goes away for Song. He tries to pick his power shots, and it doesn't tend to work.
And he does have good accuracy, but that's the thing. He'll just wait too long, and not everybody can fight like Uriah Hall, right? Like, there's a reason he's kind of an outlier in all of MMA, so this should be a really competitive fight, because again, Bedoya may not have got the win against Williams. He may beat Williams. It all depends on what your thoughts are, but if you beat Song Kinnan, I know he might not have the best record in the U.S. UFC, but that's still a very skilled opponent that you're going to gain more stock off.
We'll see who is able to learn more from me and Gary, because he trains at Killcliff and Shoot the Box. But in this matchup, we're going with the Peruvian who trains in Brazil. It is the Machine, Rolando Bedoya. Some big time fights on this card, Matt. My favorite one of the entire weekend is up next at middleweight. We have Chitty Bang Bang, Joe Kwani taking on Husar, Michael Olashechuk. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. Time middleweight action on the fringes of the top 15 coming up this weekend. We have Janjira Muay Thai Zone, Chitty Bang Bang, and Joe Kwani taking on Poland's Husar, Michael Olashechuk. And Matt, for both of these guys, in dire need of a win. Olashechuk's last time out, he got submitted by Kyle Bahalio. For Joe Kwani, lost a chintzy split decision to Albert Daraya. But for both of these guys, a lot of success outside of the UFC before they made the walk. And for Olashechuk, he was near the top of the pile with FEN. His brother, Cesari, is a champion over there, so that's awesome to see down a weight class. And Olashechuk's an interesting guy because he's bounced between 205 and 185, but he really seems to have found a home at middleweight in the UFC. And performance bonuses, they've been there for Olashechuk. He even had a debut win over Khalil Roundtree. All three judges scored at 30-27, but the athletic commission, they said, you came in a little bit too hot on the drug test. So for Olashechuk, a high-level competition in the two weight classes. For Joe Kwani, you knew him when he fought for Tachi Palace fights against Max Griffin in a main event. You knew him when he was with Bellator. At one point, he was on the poster, supposed to take on Douglas Lima. But at other points, Joe Kwani was fighting the Korshkovs of the world, and so on and so forth. And for Joe Kwani, couldn't make the weight at 170 anymore, made the move up to 185, and even in his last fight with Bellator, struggled to make that weight class when he took on the former longtime champ, Rafael Carvalho. He had a little bit of a layoff, wins at LFA 91, wins on Contender Series, and then blows through the competition to join the UFC. So, Joe Kwani's had his share of bonus money in the UFC as well. And even in the second to last fight, a loss against Gregory Rodriguez, that was a fight of the night as well. He busted up Robocop between the eyes, couldn't get it done early, got finished as that one went on. But when you look at both these guys, Matt, I mean, Joe Kwani, orthodox striker, loves to throw the kicks up to the body. For Michael Olashechuk, people might have seen it on my Twitter today. The guy has fought in 11 fights in the UFC. I can count on both hands how many leg kicks Michael Olashechuk has thrown in the UFC. He's thrown 8 total. 7 of them were very, very early on against Khalil Roundtree. He threw 1 against OSP. The last time Olashechuk threw a leg kick going into this was 1,428 days ago. But by golly, by gosh, can he ever get it done with his boxing? And that's what's gotten Olashechuk this far.
Most pitchers can't hit home runs because they don't have to. And for Michael Olashechuk, kicks aren't really a part of his game. And I got to be honest, I'm here to say I like that. Because if he is on the outside throwing those kicks, he holds his hands quite low, especially for his own boxing combinations. And that would result in him getting hit, especially in a matchup like this against Chitty and Joe Kwani. But I got to be honest, this is one of the few odds that I did look up before we started filming. I'm surprised they're so close. And maybe what I'm about to say is going to be slightly controversial. I figured Olashechuk would have been a bigger favorite, and this is why. The way that he fights is a pressure forward fighter, which eliminates a lot of the kicks from Chitty and Joe Kwani. It's difficult to throw body, leg, and head kicks while you're moving backwards, and Joe Kwani's a guy who will give up space and will give up distance in his fights. So for Joe Kwani, unless he is able to get off to such a hot start to where, hey, my kicks are taking such an effect on Olashechuk to where he can't move around as well as he normally does, or hey, I'm able to just, you know, throw a crazy flying knee and get the job done, I just worry about what Joe Kwani's going to do as his plan B and his plan C, because we do bring up that Khalil Roundtree fight all the time for Olashechuk, and I know he failed the drug test afterwards, but he showed a part of his game in that fight, at least a lot of it, that we don't often see, because a lot of people know him for the great boxing and the outside movement. He wrestled the heck out of Khalil Roundtree, like, went for double digit takedown attempts, accomplished a lot of those takedowns as well, and that is his plan B. Although we don't often see it, I think he will use the wrestling and some of the grappling if things aren't going his way, especially at distance, but I think he's gonna be able to use the boxing to get on the inside. I know he's not a fighter who really overwhelms his opponent with his volume, but he does do a good job of at least closing the distance and landing his own power shots. So for Joe Kwani, I think he's going to have to get after those kicks really early to establish that distance, because if he does find himself just backing up, The Gregory Rodriguez fight was a great one, just to be a fan of watching a fight. But the second he couldn't knock out Gregory Rodriguez and Rodriguez put those hands up and started moving forward, and Joe Kawani was just a recipient to a lot of that damage. And again, I don't think this fight's going to follow that exact script, but Oleksiychuk has a lot of those tools in his own toolbox. And I do think he moves better on the outside than even a guy like Gregory Rodriguez does.
And Joe Kawani, again, his last time out, split decision loss to Duraev. I thought Joe Kawani had done enough round two and round three. I'm definitely in the minority in the third round on that one. But if you go back and you watch it, he's able to land those big shots, and he struggled with the takedowns early in that fight. And that's always been a story, not just of his career, but his brother Anthony always struggled against the takedown, even outside of the UFC. So when you do look at this one, Lord Michael is the slight favorite in the matchup. If he's taking on a better wrestler, he tends to struggle there. If he's taking on a poor wrestler, as he is tonight, or on this weekend's card, he tends to have a lot of success. You look at the topology votes, Matt, surprised us there to you. I do think that they're going to be close. I'm going to say over under 65% Oleksiychuk.
I'm thinking 70-30, so I'll say above.
And it is under 775 total votes, 57% Oleksiychuk, 74% by knockout for the 43% that have Joe Kawani, 72% by knockout. And the thing that you like out of Oleksiychuk, though I don't know how it's going to work out in this matchup, again, southpaw versus orthodox, especially with a guy that kicks a lot out of the opposite stance, Oleksiychuk loves to go 3-2 all the time, and he likes to go to the head with that shot, or he'll go to the body, and he sets things up a lot really well, either jab or throwing that straight down towards the body to open up the head. Oleksiychuk's one of the better boxers you're going to find at 185 or 205. It's just how much of a toll those kicks take on him. If we get to that point, you have Michael Oleksiychuk in the fight.
Yeah, I thought the odds were going to be much heavier in his favor. I thought he was going to be like a minus 175, almost minus 200. Again, it just comes down to, it's difficult to kick a boxer. Like, Shannon Briggs had a K-1 fight all the way back when. You guys might know who Shannon Briggs is. Let's go, champ! But he
Logan
proved,
Paul's guy.
Either way, what he proved was, if you're a really good boxer, yes, you might not have all the tools that your opponent has, because he was getting his legs beat up early in that matchup. But if you go chest to chest with a kickboxer, they can't really kick you, and it all comes down to your hands. I think Michael Oleksiychuk is going to emphasize his boxing distance, and I think that's also going to help open up the takedown. So for those reasons, I've got Oleksiychuk.
Oleksiychuk's a 6-4 fighter in the UFC, and he did beat Khalil Roundtree. That is true. It is an old contest. But if you do look at some of these fights, Oleksiychuk's fight that he had against a similar fighter in Modestus Bukauskas was an insanely close fight, because Oleksiychuk, it seemed, respected a lot of the power out of his opponent. And when you look at the big shots out of Joe Kawani, I think he blasts Oleksiychuk out of the water in this fight, and I don't think it's going to be close. So we're split on the pick in this one. You let us know down below in the comment section who you have. Matt going with Oleksiychuk. I'm going with Chidi Joe Kawani. Some big time fights on this card, including a co-main event that you are not going to want to miss. And if you do look at this one overall, Holloway taking on Korean Zombie in the main. So why would you even bother just switching out of it? Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
A sophomore showing at bantamweight for the first of two fighters that were able to make it to the finals of the road to UFC earlier on this year. We have Toshiomi Kazama taking on a fellow sophomore attempt, and it is Marathon MMA Zone, Garrett Armfield. Matt, this is a really interesting fight at bantamweight, because for Garrett Armfield, really crisp boxing, that's the underrated part of his game. We know him so much as a wrestler, and Armfield has been a part of a lot of big time camps. We used to see him at Killcliff, we've seen him at Marathon. Maybe it was a little bit of that secret sauce with Trey Ogden to get Miranda Maverick her last win in sharing with that gym. But Armfield was also a big part of Lioness Studio when Amanda Nunes went out on her own, so a lot of heavy praise for a guy like Armfield, who's only had one fight in the UFC. It was on short notice. It was a rematch of a fight that happened when Armfield was an amateur against David Onama. And you're not going to find many bigger 45ers, but Armfield did in that one, and he was very unsuccessful. And for Armfield, he's had a couple of fights that have fallen out since. He was supposed to take on C-Rod, Christian Rodriguez. He was supposed to have another fight earlier on this year. Things just haven't been in the cards for Armfield. So now this time out, he gets to bring that boxing, that wrestling against Toshiomi Kazama, a guy whose jiu-jitsu is on point, and his wrestling can be there as well. But for Kazama's last time out, unfortunate that he fought Rinya Nakamura, and he got dropped a couple of times in that one and finished. So for Kazama, nothing but good things to say about him. I mean, you look at his jiu-jitsu, he's competing at meets all the time, But you look at how his jiu-jitsu translates into MMA, and it's perfect. It fits like a glove. So you look at it for Kazama, even that win that he had before the road to UFC tournament, and that was against Shinsuke Miyabi, and that was a one-night tournament that he had in that one. I mean, my God, like, chicken wing behind his back, like, made him tap. It was disgusting. So Kazama, great with his jiu-jitsu. And I mean, if you look at it for Kazama, out of his 10 wins, 8 of them are by submission. Like I said, I mean, he's a purple belt in jiu-jitsu. He was the IBJJF, I said ADCC, meant to say IBJJF champ. In 2018, 2019, his nickname on the regional scene was Silent Finisher. Because her parents are home, Matt. Silent wow. Finisher. That was the nickname. But if you do consider it, I mean, he was one of the guys that actually did get a bye in this tournament. His opponent, Kim Min-woo, weighed in at 139.5. So he got a bye there. Got the win over WLF War Star Karim Wali Mametwadi. And in that one, I mean, he was 27-11. One of those prospects that WLF Wars, you never know what you're going to get. And that
it's
time,
like a box of chocolates.
You got a bad fighter. So as I said, Kazama in that debut against Nakamura, the weird thing about it was, I found that in that fight, more so than any other Kazama fight on the regional scene, he chased the action with his boxing and he got completely outstruck in that one. So is it an outlier's last fight? I think Nakamura is a very, very talented fighter, and I think he's going to go on to do really big things, not just with the wrestling, but the striking as well. So Kazama, it's a little bit of a fight down, it seems. For Garrett Armfield, this is going to be in his natural weight class, and he's a very talented fighter in his own right.
I'm really curious to see if Kazama can have success off his back with his own with his own grappling in this matchup, because I do think Armfield is the better wrestler just for wrestling's sake. So, okay, whoever's going to decide to take this fight to the mat, I would assume Armfield's probably going to be the one to dictate those terms, but it's not like the fight gets that much easier the second you hit the mat. You bring it up. Kazama not only has great submission ability, he has a wide variety of submissions, and he can go for a lot too. What I like out of him, he likes that Kimura not only for a submission, but he'll use that to try to sweep his opponent. And I think that's going to be something that's really important in this matchup, because again, like I said, if Armfield's the one who's going to be securing a lot of these takedown attempts, it's going to come down to, can Kazama either threaten enough with a submission to make those takedown attempts not as frequent or as high velocity, or can he go for sweeps off his back? And I think that's going to be really important. Now, Armfield's not some like scrub on the mat. It's not like he just doesn't know what to do the second he is able to accomplish those takedowns, but if Kazama can at least make it slippery and sticky, and I guess those are two complete opposite words, but if he can make it sticky enough for him on the mat so he's not just that confident to go rinse and repeat with his own takedown attempts, I think this is going to be a phenomenal fight.
And we've seen that happen to Garrett Armfield. His fight against Canadian, now BFL champ, who's fighting on Contender Series next week, Matteo Vogel. First round, Armfield has all the success in the world. Looks like he's going to finish Vogel. And then in the second round, Vogel rallies back and he finishes Garrett Armfield. So if you look at it for Kazama, a guy who loves the chicken wing, hot dog, and bologna, he's able to get those submission wins like we've never seen before. Kazama, the other thing about him is I find it interesting when I look at gyms that I don't normally see. And for Armfield, Killcliff, Marathon, Lioness Studio, you know the cast and crew, we talk about them very often. But Kazama trains out of Heart Studio MMA over in Japan. So you look at the guys that he's training with, it's kind of similar to Tatsuro Taeda. He's out there, he's training with Chihiro Suzuki. I don't know Suzuki. I'm watching his fights, and then he knocks out Patricio Pitbull. Never thought that would happen. Kazama, he's at Heart Studio MMA, and all of a sudden, who drops into the chat a few weeks ago? Sung friggin' Yadong after the fight falls out with Rob Font. So really cool to see that for Kazama. He is the underdog in this matchup. For Armfield, you watch his fights, and I said this about Michael Olszewczyk, but Armfield loves to go jab or at least the straight to the body to make his opponents think. You saw that against Graham. He comes back up top, feints the jab, and then comes in with the uppercut, drops Graham like a sack of potatoes. Armfield is favored in this one, as I alluded to. We look at the Tapology vote. Surprise to us, they are to you. I think the fans like Armfield in this one. I'm going to say over, under 65% Armfield here.
I'll say under.
I'm going to say under. It's slightly over. 667 total votes, 68% Armfield, 76% by decision. For the 32% that have Kazama, 51% by decision, 36% by submission. So who do you have in this fight? Because I think it's going to be really competitive.
Give me the underdog. I'll take Kazama in this matchup. Again, I do think he is going to be active enough off his back. That's why I bring up those positions so often. And I do think on the feet, do I favor Armfield with his technique? Yes, I do. I think he is a little bit more crisp with his power shots. But again, it's not like he's a Max Holloway like we're seeing in the main event. If he stands in that pocket for an extra second, I could see Kazama having his own success in the feet too. And if he's able to get the top position on the mat,
that, this will be a really interesting fight to see. Folks are going to hate this episode of Fight Night Picks. You make your picks too, and you let us know who you have down below in the comments section. I like Garrett Arnfield. When I went back and I did the tape study, strong wrestling, strong positionally. That Vogel fight, we did see it kind of crack and break a little bit. But I think Arnfield is a much better striker out of these two, and I think he can really capitalize on that, because Kazama, even in his fight that he had on the road to UFC against, and I want to make sure I get it right, Karim Wally, in that one, he's chasing a lot, and he's not defending a lot. He doesn't have a lot of head movement. So we're splitting the pick in this one. Matt going with Kazama, the silent finisher. I'm going with Garrett Arnfield. You let us know down below in the comment section who you have. Some big-time fights on this card, including the next one between Waldo Cortez Acosta and Ukash Drevsky. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. Heavyweights on the outside looking in. Coming up this weekend, we have the Dominican Republic's Waldo Cortez Acosta. It's Salsa Boy, and he picked up his first pro loss as a mixed martial artist his last time out to the now 15th ranked Marcos Rogério de Lima. And in that fight, Cortez Acosta came on strong in the third round, being advised so by his corner. So for the fighter of the DR, this weekend he's going to be taking on the much defeated Ukash Drevsky. And I say much because for Drevsky, he fights Dylan Potter on Contender Series in 2021. He gets the win. It's overturned to a no contest. The Athletic Commission, USADA, he was a little bit juicy for them. But if you look at it for Drevsky, he comes in, he takes on Martin Budaj, and everybody and their dog scored it for Drevsky in that one. But Budaj ends up getting the win. It's a split decision. Drevsky goes for that sophomore showing, and we know him as a good striker who has bad takedown defense. And by gosh, by golly, did he ever have that in spades. Taken down 8 times by the wrestler Carl Williams. He also got dropped early in the second round of that one and had 0 success and looked completely gassed by about the start of the second round. So Drevsky looking as bad as you could. But if you go back and you watch his performances on the regional scene, you'll see that Drevsky in his own right has good boxing, has awesome leg kicks that open up his boxing, which in theory could cause problems for Cortez Acosta. We saw that in the Jared Vandera fight. We didn't see it where Chase Sherman has good leg kicks, but he did not go to them. But Marcos Rogério de Lima did put kind of water in that basement, to use the Teddy Atlas quote, round 2. And in round 1 as well. So for Cortez Acosta, looking to kind of pick up the pieces. And Cortez Acosta is really interesting in his own right, because he started off his MMA career as an amateur, 2015. In 2017, he started off his boxing career. But Cortez Acosta's boxing career is a lot more like Darius Flowers and Charles Johnson, to where 6-4 is good. The losses are by finish. His last time out, he got finished by Sonny Kanto really early on in that one. Kanto is still an undefeated boxer who trains with Sean Brady and Joe Pyfer. But for Cortez Acosta in MMA, we know where the detriments are, the takedown defense and the leg kicks. But again, he's got 9 wins and only 1 loss.
Drevsky just really confuses me, honestly, because even in some of his fights in the regional scene, he has good top pressure when he's able to get his opponent to the ground. He does a really good job with his half guard. He's a heavy fighter in that top position too, can go for good ground and pound, but again, it's not a position we really see him in enough, because I do think it is one of his strengths. I'm not saying it's his biggest strength, but especially in a matchup like this, if he is able to get that top spot and really hold Cortez Acosta down, A, it makes it much easier to deal with him. He is very dynamic on the feet, not only with his movement, he's got great hand speed to go along with it as well, but for Cortez Acosta, you bring it up, the takedown defense has been such a big hole that if Drevsky is going to go for takedowns in any fight in the UFC, you would have to imagine this would be one of those matchups, because again, I know he struggles a lot with that same area, but when he's able to have his own success offensively wrestling and grappling, it does make him look like a much more leveled up fighter, because on the mat, he's going to have a big advantage. On the feet, he could just find himself at a bit of a speed disadvantage, because for Cortez Acosta, he's a big guy, right? Like, he does not weigh in at the lower limit of 205, but he does move well, and I don't attribute that to his dancing. I'm sure it has a little bit to do, but for a big guy, he really does have a good level of footwork to go along with his boxing technique. So I'm really curious to see how this fight plays out, because no one likes it when I say this. I think distance management is going to be the most important thing in this matchup. If Cortez Acosta can keep that distance, throw enough volume, because that's what we'll see. We'll kind of see him get into having great volume and then kind of get away from it at different points throughout the fight. I don't think he has poor cardio by any means. I just think he has to figure out where his Goldilocks zone is, where it's not too hot, not too cold. It is just right, because when he is able to find his rhythm, he's a difficult fighter to deal with at this weight class. You just wonder that, okay, are the holes in his game so glaring that he'll never really be able to break through into that top 50?
Well, and Cortez Acosta had that opportunity to kind of take on a level up and maybe crack the rankings last time out. He loses to De Lima, who then goes on to fight Derek Lewis. So if you do look at it for Cortez Acosta, contender series, he finishes Danilo Cesarchi, and then he comes into the UFC, beats Vandera, beats Chase Sherman. Vandera fight was pretty close. The fight against, Thomas Peterson, when he was over with the LFA, wins the heavyweight strap, but he loses the first two rounds because he gets out-grappled, but he comes on strong with his boxing. Drevsky, again, even in the draw that he has on his record, and Michael Akita, he struggles in some of the grappling, but when Drevsky's on, it's the kicks that open up his own boxing. But his boxing isn't the most technical of things to his
game. It's a little stiff.
It is. It's stiff. It's odd angles. And he leaves himself open to get countered. And because of that, and because of how high up we perceive Cortez Acosta to be in the unranked heavyweight divisional rankings that are, even if you look on Tapology, it's 33 versus 82. Cortez Acosta is almost a 3-1 favorite. You look at the Tapology votes, Matt. I'm going to say over under 82.5% Cortez Acosta in this one.
I think they'll be over, but I never assumed he'd be that heavily favored by the fans.
They are over 774 total votes, 87% Cortez Acosta, 77% by decision for the 13% that have Drevsky, 81% by decision. I thought Cortez Acosta was going to be an awesome fighter coming into the UFC, and then he fought Jared Vandera, and my opinion of him completely changed. And now it's in a really weird spot. Who do you have in this matchup?
I still think he's going to be able to win this fight. If he can just stay, and it's weird to say, if he can stay on the back foot and avoid some of those bigger exchanges from Drevsky, I do think he is the more complete fighter on the feet, and I still favor his hand speed a whole heck of a lot more than Lukasz. So I do have Cortez Acosta in this matchup, but that's the thing. You bring up where they rank on Tapology. Let's be honest. Anybody who's ranked 100 to like 20 could beat each other on their worst day or best day. Like, that's how close the heavyweight division really is outside of the top 15. So I don't really see any of these fights being massive upsets by any means, but I do select Cortez Acosta.
Yeah, I mean, Drevsky's trained with Tomasz Narkun, the guys at Ankos MMA, and there's all kinds of good ones. Marcin Tybura's trained there for a really long time. Drevsky also trains with KSW fighter Zimon Bajor, and he's a really good fighter as well. But Drevsky isn't really that guy. And even his fight against Dylan Potter, did he really submit him on
contender series?
You're
not that guy, pal. You're not that guy.
We'll never know. Mark Smith's the only one to know, and the record is as well. But when it comes down to this one, I will go with Waldo Cortez Acosta, but I hate that chalk in this because he doesn't check leg kicks. He still doesn't. He hasn't learned how to do it. And that's Drevsky's biggest weapon, and he likes to go to it. And the threat of the takedown, I don't think is necessarily there for either guy. So it should be a fun striking affair. And when you're looking at a guy being a 3-1 favorite in unranked heavyweights, you just turn away. You call it popcorn, and you live to see another day. Both of us going with the DR's own Waldo Cortez Acosta. Salsa boy is way to a victory. Some big-time fights on this card, Matt, including Anthony Smith taking on Ryan Spann. I'm down to clown. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Parker Porter wakes up, and he eats his breakfast, and he goes, I want to fight Atafa. And then he eats his lunch and he goes, I hope I get to fight Atafa. And then before he goes to supper, his manager slides a contract across the table and goes, Parker, you want to fight Atafa? And he goes, yeah, sign me up for that again. Parker Porter going to take on his second Atafa in three fights. And the last time out, he got dropped and finished in the first round. Performance of the nighted against Justin Atafa. Porter looking to take on Junior Atafa and Atafa's sophomore showing in the UFC. And for Parker Porter, his last time out, he took on a mountain of a man in Braxton Smith, a guy whose tee was a little bit too tall. He got suspended by USADA. He got cut from the UFC. But Porter in that one showed off what we've seen from Porter in the UFC and abroad. The fact that Parker will strike, but it's always to clinch and then clinch for the double leg and get the takedown. The only thing that you don't like out of Porter's takedowns, or at least I don't, is that sometimes he shoots with his head out and his arms out And he gets clipped and rocked quite a bit in those exchanges.
You don't become 14-8 by being flawless.
Nah, and the chin is there, and sometimes the receipt is too for Parker
Porter. The thing about Parker Porter is, and please correct me, because this is how I've always felt about him, he kind of fights like a middleweight in the heavyweight division, but his body's massive. Like, he's got surprisingly good cardio for the weight division. He's got good pop on
his
movement.
He's fleet of foot.
100%. He fights like a guy who is the middleweight who moved up to heavyweight. He's fought everybody at this point. I can't think of his name. Apologies. But
Jake Collier.
Thank you. Jake Collier. He does remind me a little bit of Parker Porter because, again, you might assume, hey, he weighs 256. He's a big guy for the weight division. He must fight like some big power puncher. But that's not the case at all about Parker Porter. He does have a very good depth of skills. He is very well-rounded. But the problem in the heavyweight division is, look at everybody who's ever held the title. More than any other division, heavyweights can get away with just being specialists. Look at guys like Fabricio Verdum. I know he added a lot to his striking as his career progressed, but for a lot of his career, he was primarily a submission artist and BJJ fighter. Cain Velasquez has great boxing, but it was the wrestling that got him to the dance. Stipe, he is primarily a boxer. Like, most of these fighters at the top of the division, in heavyweight more than any, you can get away with being a specialist. But Parker Porter doesn't really have that one area that he can always win a fight at. Do you disagree with that, Bro?
I think you threw darts on a board and you poked holes in your argument by mentioning their two good skills to make it all the way to the
top. But they were all guys who emphasized one part of their game until later in their career.
In this fight, Matt, for Parker Porter, he does struggle sometimes close that distance, and he will get clipped. We've seen him against some good fighters in the UFC, but most have been outside of the rankings. The last two losses, Jailton Almeida and Justin Taffa. For Junior Taffa, made his debut against Muhammad the Motor Usman, and it was kind of what it was.
Dana White put out one of those great tweets, if you don't know, now you know, Taffa versus Usman, you know, to fire up the masses, and then they witnessed that fight.
They can't all hit.
Those were two tired men in that matchup.
But for Junior Taffa, again, he turned pro in MMA last July, and he already has four knockout wins. And if you look at the level of competition, it's kind of all over the place. Like, the first pro fight, he takes on Taisi Sakino, and in that one, I mean, Sakino, he's one of those guys that kind of fought not really the greatest level of competition. He goes in there, blitzes him, drops him once, he gets back up, and he drops him again. He goes out there and he fights a guy who's fought everybody, and Kevin Fitzial, who's 15-12-2 at the time, but Fitzial had fought, like, really, really, really big names up until that point. I know one of them was Rakeem Cleveland. I know he had some wins over some good guys, some losses to some good guys. That fight was all over the place. Fitzial was able to go out there, get some takedowns. Taffa was able to knock him down in that one. Taffa then goes out and he fights Nicholas Jurjevic over with Brave. And in that one, Jurjevic runs across the cage, gets the takedown, and Taffa's in really compromised positions to start that one. He ends up somehow getting back up to his feet, lands an uppercut, drops his opponent, gets in top control, lands a ground and pound. And his last time he takes on, see, I'm trying to sound like I'm from Australia, takes on Tiyoshi Sudario, who's a guy that wasn't allowed to be a sumo wrestler anymore because he hit a couple of clubbies, like, in and around some of the fights, allegedly. But he was forced to withdraw from being a pro sumo fighter. Was a decent pro MMA fighter, but in that one, it was the leg kicks. It was those long-range attacks out of a guy like Taffa. And then I went down through and I watched some of these, glory kickboxing bouts that he had. Because as a kickboxer, 23-5 with 19 knockout wins was Taffa. And the leg kicks are great. The uppercuts are great. The mixing from the body up to the head are some of the better weapons that he has. But out of even some of the losses and in the tournaments that he was a part of with Glory, he takes on Jamal Ben Sadiq. And if you know Ben Sadiq,
he's very good.
He's very good. He ended up being a champ and fighting Rico Verhoeven.
Had a crazy fight with Rico, yeah.
The way that fight went, early on in it, Taffa's cut falls out. And then he's got to put it back in. And then it falls out again. And the referee says, if this happens one more time, this is the end of the fight. You can see Taffa continuing to try and adjust it. And out of it, I mean, some really kind of close to the belt strikes by Ben Sadiq. And it ends up, that's how Taffa ends up getting finished. And Taffa's also fought, and I want to make sure I get it right, Ajibayi. And in that one, he's a guy that had fought and trained with Verhoeven. It was supposed to be Guto Inocenci who had beaten Taffa, but in the same night, Inocenci couldn't continue due to the cut. So Taffa ends up taking the fight, and he gets his legs kicked completely out from under him. He's dropped or knocked down three times due to the leg kick, so he doesn't win. He lost to some of the better kickboxers over with Glory when he was 22, 23 years old. He's progressed to this point as an MMA fighter under the tutelage of Mark Hunt and his brother, Justin Taffa. So if I call Junior Justin throughout this video, I apologize. It's just, when I watch Taffa fight in MMA, his overall kickboxing skill set translates better to MMA than I think is even his brother Justin's does. I would hope. And I think Junior Taffa has a pretty darn high ceiling in this fight and in overall MMA, as long as he can work some of that takedown defense. Because as I said, Dragicevic was able to run across the cage and take him down. And that fight was about 4 months ago. So Junior Taffa was able to show us what we had seen on the way up. Yeah, he only had 4 fights. And yeah, they were all wins. And they had all happened since July 2022. But the takedown defense was a question mark before. It's still a question mark after the Usman fight. And honest to goodness, I scored that fight for Taffa. I thought he'd won 2 rounds on the power of striking alone. I liken that to Jeremiah Wells, Matthew Semelsberger. Semelsberger landed all the power shots, but he struggled in the wrestling. And that same thing happened to Taffa. And now we're going to get to see if it happens against Parker Porter in this one. Taffa is the slight favorite in the matchup coming out of NTG Fight and Fitness down in Australia. We have a look at the fan vote on Tapology, Matt. Surprise to us, it is to you. I'm going to say over under 60% Junior Taffa.
I think it's going to be under.
I think it's going to be under. It's way over. 765 total votes, 83% Taffa, 88% by knockout for the 17% that have Porter, 58% by decision, 33% by knockout. Matt, it should be noted, Parker Porter, 249, his last time out, was the lowest he had weighed since his light heavyweight day when he fought John Jones. Porter was one of the bigger heavyweights that was out there. So he would look really fleet of foot against Braxton Smith. He was able to eat a few of those big right hands, and his chin didn't completely degrade. Once he got the takedown, it wasn't really a takedown. Braxton Smith pushed forward. Porter did the old snap down city like he's Tony Ferguson. Snapped the neck down, pushed him down, got to the back, landed the TKO, and he was able to get the win from ground and pound. But who do you have in this fight? Because I know the odds are close. I see it as close, but the fans, they don't at all. Taffa.
I have Parker Porter, honestly, in this matchup, just because so I think he's going to be able to close the distance well enough and avoid some of those big shots in the in-between. Now, Junior Taffa has a brother, Justin Taffa, and maybe we do get one of those situations like when Shawn Michaels fought The Undertaker inside the Hell in a Cell. I don't know if you know this, but oh my God! That's Kane! That must be his brother! And Kane comes out of nowhere and makes his intro. So maybe Justin somewhere is in the back and he decides to make an appearance, but I do think if Porter can avoid that big shot, I sound like a broken record, because how many times do we say that breaking down his fights, then he should be able to win. So I do have Parker Porter in the matchup.
I think Parker Porter gets the win as well. Junior Taffa, what we saw with Glory, the leg kicks, the strikes up the middle, he struggled with having a magnet in his cup earlier on in his career. But he is such a pure and good striker. And he's one of two guys on this card with that Glory lineage. And we've seen Glory kickboxers. Dustin Jacoby made it to the top 15 at light heavyweight. We've seen Alex Pareto win a title. Giga Chikadze, again, the guy on the card. Junior Taffa as well. Some guys have fanned right out. But in this one, Porter's going to have to be careful because of what I said. He likes to throw big shots, leave his head out there, go for your legs, clinch you up, and then get the takedown. Once he gets the clinch, he has a lot of success. Taffa struggled getting away from the clinch against Usman, and that's why I think Porter can have success. So both of us going with the underdog in this one, in Parker Porter out of the Heavy Hitters Club to get the win. But we'll see if Junior Taffa has what John Anik said his brother had, the touch of death. And it'll be an interesting fight at heavyweight in this one. Some big time fights on this card, Matt, including the next one between Aaron Blanchfield and Tyler Santos. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. February 18th, earlier on this year, we were supposed to get a main event that featured these two women. And unfortunately, on a week's notice, Santos was out and in stepped Jessica Andrade, who's promptly been finished 3 straight times. So, Matt, when it does come down to this matchup, it is a top-ranked affair. And originally, when these two were to face off, Tyler Santos, she's still off that title fight loss. It was a really close fight against Valentina Shevchenko. But at that time, Santos was ranked number one in the world, and Blanchfield was ranked 10th. Now, when you look at this matchup, Blanchfield ranked a spot ahead of Santos. But it still feels like they're really close, and they were close, even though they were far apart, if that makes any sense. And you look at a fight like this, Tyler Santos feigning some of those strikes. You saw it against Joanne Wood. Going up top to land that big shot, getting the finish. Santos against Roxanne Modafferi and the like. Santos has only really struggled against, well, that weird fight where she took on Mara Romero Barella. And then, of course, Valentina Shevchenko. But Santos has leveled up fight in and fight out. really powerful striker, really picks those power shots well. And for Blanchfield, we've always touched on this. Her fight against Vittoria Leonardo with Invicta, where she's landing that double head kick and getting the finish. The striking was always there, but the head movement and the movement on the feet necessarily wasn't. We saw it kind of questioned when she took on JJ Aldridge a few fights ago. She loses in the volume strike in the first round. She gets the submission in the second round. But where Blanchfield, I found, took a big level up was you're taking on a former champ, Jessica Andrade, and Blanchfield didn't necessarily move her head all that much, but she was able to dominant cruise her way in and around with the movement on the feet, and we really did see a level up in that one. She gets the striking done in the first round. Two of the judges scored it for her in that first. In the second round, she gets it done, gets the takedown, quick into side control, and she ends up getting the finish. It was a very impressive win for Blanchfield in that one.
It was, but I still feel like this is a much more important fight for her whole career. And I know what people always say, the next fight's always the most important, but I gotta be honest, I just don't think Jessica Andrade looked great that last match. It was on short notice, it was against a fighter who is much bigger than her, and I know she's had success at the weight class, but still, there was a lot of oh by the ways for Andrade, and I know she hasn't looked great since that fight, so it's difficult for me to say, but again, taking a fight in a main event situation on short notice isn't really doing that fighter any favors, and I agree with all the improvements, at least the movement that Erin Blanchfield had, but I just don't know if we can take a ton from that performance, because what has Andrade struggled with, especially as of late? It's been her grappling defense, it's been her ability to just take punches to the head. It really has been a lot of her game, and I worry that she has been slowing down, whereas against Tyler Santos, you're not really going to worry as much about the one pop power that Jessica Andrade has, but she's got the volume, she's got the lasting ability, and those are going to be really important, because people like to overhype a lot of prospects on their way up, right? They want to say, hey, Miranda Maverick might be the second best fighter in this division after she had one win. I'm just making fun of you, John Manick. You're very smart, and I like you a lot. But for Erin Blanchfield, she really has that had that progression to her career where it's, hey, you're fighting Miranda Maverick, you're fighting Macy Barber, fighters that people really do know and enjoy. When you beat other prospects, it does put you a step ahead of them. And in her last time out, beating Jessica Andrade, having that one big name on your resume, does show that you belong at this stage. But Tyler Santos is going to prove, hey, you're ready for a title shot if you're able to beat her. Because Santos, I know she lost the fight against Valentina, but it's not like she got 50-45 and had no success whatsoever. Even on the feet, she was able to have a little bit of success when she was able to get in Valentina's face. And for all the strengths that Blanchfield does have, we haven't seen her have to fight backwards all that often. It's been moments here, moments there, but we've never seen her on the back foot consistently round after round where she is eating a lot of damage. So I wonder, A, can she implement her kicks if she is backing up a lot in this matchup? Because she does have very powerful kicks for being such a grapple heavy fighter. You don't often see that. Normally it's just a lot more boxing, but I do think Blanchfield has all the tools to go out there and at least challenge for the title. It's difficult to say, hey, she'd beat Alexa Grasso because Grasso is so talented, but Blanchfield has shown us fight in and fight out that she is making those progressions toward the top of the title or towards the title picture. I think that's really important to see. It's not just like she started out really strong and is maintained as the same fighter.
I don't know. I mean, Blanchfield, yeah, she's added different bits and tools to her game, but she fought a high-level competition with Invicta. The only loss on Blanchfield's record is a split decision to Tracy Cortez. Strong argument that Blanchfield had won that one. And for Santos, her last time out, I thought that Shevchenko at least convincingly won three of those rounds.
I thought she won, definitely.
But if you do consider it, a lot of folks had thought that Santos had won. The lasting image at the end of the fight, Santos is eye is swollen up and you need a stake to get that one under control, but we haven't seen Santos, and now all of a sudden from 1 to 4, you're leapfrogged a little bit in the divisional rankings, considering now Shevchenko's one, and then you have Fiotto, and then Blanchfield after that. In the original video for this one, I thought about throwing in a 7-minute clip and saying, see you later, alligator, I'm not making a video on it, but we both took Tyler Santos to get the win in this fight, and she was favored to win it. Now she's the underdog, so I'm really eager to see who the fans have on Tapology in this one. I'm going to say over-under. We're going to go with the fighter that continues to win, and I'm going to say 70% Blanchfield in this one.
I think it's going to be over because of recency bias.
And it is. So 819 total votes, 83% Blanchfield, 73% by decision. For the 17% that have Santos, 79% by decision. So the fans see this one going by decision. And I think that kind of adds credibility, even though more have Blanchfield to win, that you're taking on a really tough test in Tyler Santos, somebody that maybe Blanchfield can't finish. And for me not to have Blanchfield to beat Andrade on that shorter notice, I don't do that to discredit Blanchfield whatsoever. I talk about the level ups. Her boxing has continued to get better. I think her striking accuracy is better. A lot of punches will end up hitting her arms because she leaves them out there a lot to block shots. And it's worked for a women's flyweight. So we'll see how that continues on. She's also a fighter that has had in the past aspirations to fight at 135, even almost had a fight booked at 135 in the UFC. So when it does come down to this one, Matt, the pinpoint accuracy of Tyler Santos that we kind of haven't talked about so much because the hype is on with Erin Blanchfield, but who do you have in a matchup like this?
This is one of those fights where you're going to look dumb no matter what you say. Because if I say Erin Blanchfield's going to go out there and dominate using her wrestling and her top pressure to really open up her ground game, then Tyler Santos is probably going to 30-27 her way to a dominant decision. But if I say Santos is going to do that, then she's probably going to get ground and pounded in the first round. I have a difficult time with this matchup because both fighters have very clear paths to victory, but they're very different with how they're going to go out there and pursue them. I do think the distance management ability of Tyler Santos is going to be a big factor in this fight. If she's able to use her kicks, and I don't think she should use a lot of them to make it very clear, because that's just another opportunity for Blanchfield. Not even get a takedown, just get a trip and end up on top in that position. But I think if Santos can use some of those kicks early, it's really going to help open up her game. All that being said, I'm going to switch my pick from the original five-round main event fight that they were going to have, because I do think Blanchfield's going to be able to go out there and use the wrestling for at least two of those three rounds. And all that means is, if you stay on top for 2 minutes, you're probably going to win that round. And if you do it again for the second one, you'll do the same. So I've got Blanchfield in the matchup, but this is as close of a fight as any on the card.
The same people that are out there every week in the comments section that say you got to pick more underdogs, you got to agree on every single pick, I got to win every time, they're not going to like this. I still have Tyler Santos in the fight. The reason being is the Jillian Robertson fight, she completely dominated in the grappling exchanges. The Molly McCann fight, she dominated in the grappling exchanges. The only fight that Tyler Santos heavily struggled at in terms of the takedowns, and it was somewhat of a close fight on the rewatch, the fight against Mara Romero-Barella. And we haven't seen that since. We've seen a level up from Santos in the defensive grappling abilities. Erin Blanchfield is that next level fighter.
I think she would out-grapple Jillian Robertson.
That's where you're going to see it tested. But for me, I still have Santos in this fight. I think the striking can carry her to a victory. So we're split. And you got to consider the last time out, that was originally scheduled to be a five rounder. This one now at 3. Matt going with Erin Blanchfield. I'm going with Tyler Santos. 83% on Tapology going with Blanchfield, so I can see the wave of support down there in the comment section. But make sure you let us know who you have in this fight. A big time prospect matchup in our next one. Fernie Garcia looking for UFC win number 1 against Road to UFC winner Rinya Nakamura. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Rinya Nakamura, the hybrid, comes from Japanese MMA royalty coming up this weekend. He's going to be taking on Mexico's own Fernie Garcia. Garcia looking for his first UFC victory after coming in on Dana White's Contender Series. And when I saw that this fight got booked, I went, why? Because Fernie Garcia, the book's been out on him for a long time. He is a really good boxer.
Yeah.
Really fast hands. He can mix in his power shots. He goes body head quite a bit. He's not the biggest leg kicker. But if he does throw that leg kick out there, you can take him down. And his wrestling defense is not all that good. And you've seen that from Garcia in the UFC against Jurnee Newsome and against Brady Heastand. He got absolutely mauled when it came to those grappling positions. Rinya Nakamura is a very, very good wrestler who just so happened to knock out a fighter in the first round his last time out. If you look at it for Rinya Nakamura, he's probably the most polished of the guys that are fighting, the 8 fighters in these tournament finals, oh, yeah. Whether it's from flyweight all the way up to lightweight. And you might know Nakamura from, like, you know, wrestling meets, you know, because if you look at him, I mean, the 2017 under 23, 61 kilogram world champion freestyle wrestler, and he's definitely that type of prospect. He competed at Worlds in 2018. Team Japan finished 3rd in that tournament in Iowa. And if you look at it for Nakamura, I mean, this is a guy like his family or his father was one of the originators of Shooto MMA over in Japan in the 90s. So really cool stuff there from Nakamura. But you look at it, already 6-0 as a pro. He just debuted a couple of years ago in 2021. And that was it. I mean, when wrestling 2017, 2018, he kind of hit his peak. He had a plan on going to the Olympics. But with the way that things went, he just decided to transition into MMA. And by goodness, I'm glad he did.
He's pretty good at it.
You look at this guy from Southpaw, you look at the striking that he possesses, he doesn't necessarily look just like a wrestler. And I think of guys that got to the nth degree of wrestling, ended up in the UFC or the top levels of MMA. You look at a guy like Mark Madsen with his Greco-Roman. I mean, Mark Madsen probably dreams of fighting like Rinya Nakamura someday. Like, you look at this guy, and he's
really... Let's wait till he gets to the UFC.
Yeah, but he's really, really scratched the surface of what you can become, having just such a high-level skill set. And my God, for physique levels out of a guy like Nakamura, the guy's built like a brick you-know-what house.
Well, he's a world champion level wrestler, most of them are.
But let's say he has any troubles on the mat, and I don't even think he's going to have that, if I'm being completely honest. But let's say he does get uncomfortable from the top position. Well, he's the one with the wrestling advantage. He can decide whether or not they are grapplers or they are going to be strikers. And on the feet, I do think Nakamura not only is the more complete striker, he's the more heavy-handed striker out of the two. He's the far better boxer. I shouldn't say striker, because Nakamura is not going to go in there and hit you with a high level of kicks. He's not going to be like Jamal Hill, throw a bunch of head kicks, a bunch of body kicks. He will work primarily behind the boxing, but like we've seen out of a lot of dominant wrestlers, boxing's great for wrestlers because it makes you compete in that close range, and that helps you with both. The legs right there to grab, the head's right there to punch, and I do think Nakamura does have a decided advantage in the striking, which is really going to matter.
The thing about Rinya Nakamura is, you don't want to use the word Bo Nickel, right? Like, Bo Nickel is the cream of the crop when it comes to prospects, but the nice thing to see out of Nakamura is, again, you're going to know about the wrestling, and you assume that is going to be such a dominant part of his game that that's all you're going to see. Oh my goodness, this man has layers, like an ogre, like an onion. And those are the nice things to see out of Nakamura, because you understand what his foundational skill set is, but you also realize that he has so many other parts to his game. And you're right, for Fernie Garcia, he can make a fight exciting, right? Against basically anybody. You could be a box full of pool noodles at a Walmart, and Fernie Garcia could probably have a fight of the night with you. The problem is, if he can't defend the takedown, especially not early, yes, I do think he has probably more complex strikes than Nakamura. Nakamura does have very heavy hands, but again, it's not like he's going out there throwing Max Holloway level combinations, so maybe Garcia can make him burn his arms out going for a lot of takedowns. He can stuff all of them. I can't believe that these words are coming out of my mouth, because I don't believe that's going to happen. I just think for Rinya Nakamura, he has shown not only the ability to be one of those top-level prospects, but again, he's got the plan B, the plan C to go along with the dominant skill set.
Now, what I do like out of this one, and this is for both guys, for Fernie Garcia, still out of Fortis MMA, great gym. You're going to be working with a lot of wrestlers in that room. And the other good thing for Fernie Garcia is, think about a guy from 155 down that makes the trip, what is it, like 9 hours from his home gym to go there? Carlos Diego Fajeda. Hopefully that guy was able to help out Fernie Garcia just a smidge, if at all possible. For Rinya Nakamura, LDH Martial Arts in Japan, but for this camp, full camp for weeks on end to turning into it months at American Top Team. And you like to see that for Rinya Nakamura, as not even an already polished product, but he went just about as far as you can go with his wrestling to not have an Olympic medal around his neck, to then transition into mixed martial arts. Nakamura is a pretty darn big favorite in this matchup. We have a look at the Tapology votes. I don't think they're going to be all that close. I'm going to say over under 95% Nakamura.
You hit me with a 97 earlier. I thought you were going to go back to it. I'll say under just because it's such a hot. Oh my goodness.
It's 789 total votes, 98% Nakamura, 73% by knockout for the 2% that have Garcia, 53% by decision, and 21% by knockout. Matt, I think Rinya Nakamura wins this fight, and I don't think he's going to try and keep it standing like he did his last time out against Toshiomi Kazama, who's a good jiu-jitsu player, so why not strike with him? But against Garcia, probably not wise to strike. We saw Joshua Weems do that, and Weems is a guy that's good with his grappling, but he can struggle sometimes leaving himself open. So hopefully for Nakamura, the good people at American Top Team have him in safe hands in this one.
If Akeem Olajuwon had a 1v1 against Greg Ostertag, I don't know if he'd be a minus 700 favorite. Like, that's how big of a deal Nakamura is. He has so many skills he can go to, like you said. Not only the power in his hands, I think we will see the wrestling side of him in this match. It would be ridiculous if we didn't see it. So I do have Nakamura, but again, these are the fights where just show us more, right? Show us more every single time out so that you can kind of justify your way moving up the division, because bantamweight's wide open right now. We have a brand new champion at the top, a lot of fresh matchups to make. So if Nakamura can really solidify himself in this division, he can move up pretty quick.
You have a new Ultimate Fighter bantamweight winner and Canadian, Brad Katona. But listen, you win the Ultimate Fighter, you get a nice trophy. You win Road to UFC, you get to fight in an Apex and you don't get a trophy. Matt, both of us going with the Road to UFC winner from earlier on this year, Rinya Nakamura, to get the win. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have some big time matchups. There's just a few of them left on this card. Toss a like on your way through. Keep it locked in with Fight in Apex, we always say. Let's get into it. big-time banger on the main card at featherweight in ranked action. We have the return. It's been 588 days away for Giga Chikadze's last time out, a fight of the night against Calvin Kattar, where he took a lot of damage. And for Chikadze, he gets the return in action against Alex Caceres, who won in a co-main event back in June against Daniel Pineda. That was also a fight of the night. So both of these guys, they are absolute bonus machines. And Alex Caceres ranked 15th in this division. He's 16-11 with one no contest. Who has he not fought? He's fought Max Holloway, right?
He has.
He's fought some of the best guys in this division. And maybe he hasn't come out on the winningest of ends, but for Caceres, since June of 2019, he's 7-1, and he's been ultra competitive, picking up bonuses, picking up finishes, and now he's looking to really kind of jump the line in a ultra stacked featherweight division. For Chikadze, the long layoff, he did a little bit of that radio row there at UFC X, the fan experience, back in July, and he touched on the fact that fights with Sadiq Youssef fell out. A teased fight against Brian Ortega, yeah, that was a real thing that they were targeting. That one fell out as well. And he also said when he did his interview with MMA Junkie Radio, Gorgeous George goes, he said that he went through 5 surgeries between the last time that we saw him fight to now. So Chikadze, it also seemed like he broke his right hand, and he kind of touched on that. The last 2 fights, the Calvin Kattar fight and the Barboza fight, he had a broken right hand. He was able to get that repaired. A lot of stem cells, a lot of doctor visits, and now he's back in there. And we said it earlier on in this card, Junior Tafa, Glory Lineage, Giga Chikadze, Glory Lineage, and I wasn't sold on Chikadze off his performance on Contender Series. 2018, he lost to Austin Springer. He wanted to show that extra wrinkle to his game being the grappling. And when he did, he ended up getting finished. And if you want to play MMA math, Alex Caceres beat Austin Springer in the UFC. But Chikadze went back to the regional scene, beat a couple of guys that had pulses, and then he ended up in there against Brandon Davis. He continues his winning ways. He had a really wild fight against a good fighter in Jamal Emmers. That was a really memorable one. But Chikadze ended up continuing to level up. He beats Barboza, he beats Cub Swanson, and then he ends up in that Kattar fight. And I know I said it was a fight of the night. 50-45s and a 50-44, it was kind of like how Chris Moutinho, Sean O'Malley was a fight of the night.
I think it was a little bit more competitive than the scorecards might suggest. He lost, don't get me wrong. I'm not going to sit here and tell you I thought Giga won. But, like, he did hit Calvin Kattar with some really good shots. And I'm not going to sit here and say I think Alex Caceres would do much better in that type of a matchup. So, this is what I have a really hard time with. Outside of the time off and the injuries, I think Giga Chikadze wins this fight. Not easily, but, like, Alex Caceres doesn't have a lot of the obvious skill sets that Giga Chikadze struggles with. What does Giga struggle with? If you get on the inside of his kicking range and force him to become a boxer, you can have success in that one range. Caceres normally implements his kicks in all of his striking exchanges, and not that Caceres can't grapple, but he's not of that nth degree to where, okay, you have to respect his takedown attempts so much to where you're dropping your hands and almost sprawling preemptively to defend those kind of takedowns. So if Alex Caceres decides he's just going to stand on the outside and strike with Giga Chikadze, I just don't know how much margin of error that gives him in this fight, because Chikadze is the much more devastating striker between these two. Like, his kicks, his punches, when he's landing them, he is very damaging.
Giga Chikadze, in his short time in the UFC, 7th all-time in featherweight history with a knockdown average per 15 minutes of 0.89. That's behind your guy, Chad Mendes.
I love Chad Mendes' fight so much, it's ridiculous. One of my favorite fighters to watch of all time. But that's the big thing about Chikadze. Yes, on the outside, he might not be the highest volume, right? He can get caught just staring. But if Alex Caceres is throwing a high volume at him, I remember saying this a lot when Petr Yan fought Aljamain Sterling the first time. What's Yan so good at? Holding his hands up and just waiting for you to show him everything, and then he decides to go. I think Chikadze can have a similar game plan in this matchup. Wait for Alex Caceres to throw a lot of his volume, really start moving downhill, and that's going to leave you even more openings to start countering off the back foot. And yes, in a 15 minute fight, you do worry that he could, you know, lose that first round, have a close second round, and then who knows what's going to happen in the third. But if these guys match each other strike for strike, I favor Chikadze. If Caceres goes for a lot of takedowns, I can see that just tiring him out, especially as the fight goes on, because Chikadze, for as good a power that he has, he's not a guy who's going to go out there and overthrow a lot of his shots like a Vanderlei Silva. He's not going to sit down and throw massive looping hooks to where, okay, Caceres might be able to move out of the way and counter with his own power. So I hate to be so one-sided in this, but I do really struggle to see how Caceres is going to go out there and win rounds.
If he's going to be able to go out there and grapple, I think he can win rounds. And Chikadze's talked about that, even talked about that in the Radio Row interviews. I've been training in the gi, I've been training no gi, I've been doing a lot of grappling. He talked about that before the Springer fight. And then it got him caught. Caceres is a guy that you don't want to screw around with any of that. You remember the Sung Woo Choi fight that we referenced earlier? Caceres gets dropped. He then gets the back. He gets the choke. Caceres is a grappler like that, where you can be sneaky in those positions.
He's also been out grappled a number of times.
Four performance bonuses in the UFC. Four fight of the nights for Caceres. For Giga, performances in every fight. Jamie Simmons, Giga kick against Cub Swanson. The Edson Barboza win. And then, of course, against Calvin Kattar. And for Chikadze, I had like one of those one-off videos before the fight. It was a key to a Giga Chikadze win. What was the key? I'll spoil it now. It was pacing. Giga Chikadze is one of those guys that tends to pace himself in three round and in limited sample size five round fights. He got struck on the outside and couldn't get past the jab and the 1-2s of Calvin Kattar.
That's
in that
more on
matchup.
The inside, though. On the outside, Chikadze can kick. On the inside, where jabs are happening, I would say that's more middle to inside range.
If you've got a long jab,
you're still boxing is never on the outside because you're not throwing kicks in MMA.
Calvin Kattar had kicks. A nice long jab, and Giga Chikadze didn't throw his right hand and didn't throw his kicks. So in this one, I don't know what Giga Chikadze is going to look like. I need to see this fight before I can make an approximation on the rest. So I kind of stay away from this one, pop and popcorn wise. Chikadze is a pretty big favorite coming off the layoff, the injuries. Alex Caceres, again, so hot right now. Finished Julian Erosa, the head kick knockout seen around the world last year. And then, of course, last time out against Daniel Pineda, a really, really, really wild fight. And he was able to win out in the striking, the grappling in that one. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. One guy's a fan favorite. One guy's hovered around that.
They both are easily.
Again, you don't see a lot of people going to a party going, man, Alex Caceres is my favorite fighter.
You ever heard anybody say that about Bernie Garcia, Rinya Nakamura, Aaron Blanchfield, Anthony Smith, or Ryan Spann? Because I haven't either. At least Alex Caceres has been in the main event of Fight Nights before, unlike a lot of these fighters.
Nobody's saying, past the chip dip, I can't get ready for an 0-2 Fernie Garcia performance. Nothing will surprise me out of this one. The fans, I'm going to say over under 80% Giga Chikadze.
I'll say over.
You're going to say over? I swear. 770 total votes, 80% Chikadze, 56% by decision, 37% by knockout. For the 20% that have Caceres, 52% by decision, 32% by submission. Again, unless Alex Caceres is able to control distance with his kicks and then crowd the inside and go for some of the grappling, I think Giga Chikadze can get the win in this.
I've got Giga in this matchup. This to me really does feel like a get back on the horse kind of a fight. Like, Calvin Kattar is a difficult matchup for pretty much anybody who's not going to fight for the title immediately. Like, that's how good Calvin Kattar is. And I know Chikadze didn't look great in that matchup, but again, if Caceres fought Calvin Kattar, it's probably going to look the same, if not even worse. So I don't think you can put a ton of stock into that. I do worry about the injuries and the time off, especially both guys are 35, right? 145. That's not an age we see a ton of guys have success afterwards at, so we'll be curious as to whether or not age catches up to either one of them, but I do have Giga Chikadze.
We'll see if Caceres can utilize that tricky southpaw stance and a little bit of an uptick in volume compared to Chikadze. Will it be the Georgian winning out? Both of us going with the returning ninja Chikadze to get the win. A big time co-main event coming up. It's a rematch of a 2021 main event. We have Anthony Lionheart Smith taking on Ryan Superman Spann. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get in. Do it. It's the rematch of a 2021 main event. We have Anthony Lionheart Smith taking on Superman Ryan Spann. And both guys met in the small cage. It was Ryan Spann kind of crowding Anthony Smith. Picks him up on one side of the octagon. Carries him across to the other side. And then out of it, they break. And Anthony Smith decides he's going to strike like he's Ryan Spann and wing power shots. Two of them hit Ryan Spann, and he's on baby deer legs. And as the fight continues to progress, Anthony Smith is able to beat up on Ryan Spann. We saw an armbar attempt at one point that looked like it was going to be tight. But by the end, Smith gets the back. Smith gets the finish. And listen, people might not like Ian Machado Gary after what he did against Neil Magny at UFC 292. But Anthony Smith, he was not happy with Ryan Spann after that fight. Smith, after that, has gone on to lose a couple in a row. His last time out did not look very good against Shawnee Walker. For Ryan Spann, he won two in a row in the first round, and then his last time out, he took on Nikita Krylov, and he got grappled into a pretzel. So when you look at a fight like this, Matt, Ryan Spann still just an absolute bit of a buzzsaw to the brain. The fact that he used to be a longtime middleweight, but he was.
He's huge.
And that really happened. He fought Trevin Giles one time, but for Spann, he's one of the bigger guys at 205. And for Anthony Smith, longtime middleweight in his own right, he looks a little bit more like a normal light heavyweight. And Smith, we know, he's had the big time fights. He had the title fight back at UFC 235. In total for Anthony Smith, 19 UFC fights, 11-8, 8 main event slots, and 1 co-main event.
He's gone
5-4 in those spots. So again, for Smith, the 2 losses in a row, one against Johnny Walker, one against Magomed Ankalaev, pretty tough outs in those ones. But Smith, again, his last time out was troubling for more reasons than one, and it might cause you some question marks in this fight against Spann.
Where is Anthony Smith on, like, the Nomar Garcia-Para career line? You know, like, Nomar was awesome.
I think it's Dodgers line.
He was good for a couple seasons with them, and then it fell apart. That's the thing about Anthony Smith. You don't need us to tell you the amount of high-profile fights that this guy has been in. He's been in the top of the division, not really at middleweight, but ever since he moved up to 205, he's really inserted himself as one of the dominant fighters in this division. And I know it started with a weird win over Rashad Evans. Yeah, you wouldn't think a whole career trajectory would start with a win over Shogun and Rashad.
Hold on. Prelims against Rashad Evans gets a win. Main event in Europe against Tiny Trunk Shogun Hua.
And that was an oddly fun fight. It wasn't. It was sad to watch for Shogun. Shogun himself was crying on the way to the ring. But you have to ask yourself, just how much does Anthony Smith have left? And I don't mean he's not going to go out there and try his best to win this fight. The guy got that dog in him. He's got a lion in him, if you will. But for Smith, how much damage can he take until he just can't respond anymore? Because think of the Glover fight. What?
Yeah.
Glover beat his teeth out. Like, Anthony Smith has taken a life-altering amount of damage throughout his MMA career. He is 36-18, and a lot of those stoppages, or a lot of those losses, have come by way of stoppage. And I know his chin did get better once he did find his way to 205. He can take body shots a little bit better. He can take shots to the head better, too. But again, Ryan Spann, even though he got hurt in their first matchup, and Ryan Spann's another guy who, when you think everything's going great, it all comes tumbling down. But Spann, if he can get on the inside of Anthony Smith and hit him with a few shots, especially early, I wonder if that gets him enough respect to where Anthony Smith won't just rush for it with his own offense. Because Smith, remember the Jimmy Crute fight? The Jimmy Crute fight for Anthony Smith is one that kind of gets brushed under the rug because, hey, Crute had a knee injury. But you gotta remember what happened in the early goings of that fight. Smith had really stayed in the middle of the cage, used his jab effectively, and used a lot of those long-range tools like the leg kicks to his own benefit in that matchup. And I think that's when Anthony Smith is fighting at his best, when he's able to use the kicks, not moving backwards up against the cage like we talk about all the time, but use the kicks and move forward and fight with that confidence that we have seen throughout the past.
And Ryan Spann, a lot of people are gonna really love those last two wins that he had. Iwan Kutsalaba and, of course, Dominic Reyes. Reyes comes back, power jab. Boom. And as he lands the jab, Reyes starts to fall back, and then he lands the right hand and kind of drops him even more. But Spann in the UFC, a couple of bonuses, Kutsalaba and Misha Cirkunov. For Anthony Smith, 6 performance bonuses and 1 fight of the night to his credit. But when I look at Ryan Spann, this is where numbers are deceiving. Sometimes I'll mention like a knockdown ratio and then I just brush it under the rug. For Anthony Smith in the UFC, not Strikeforce, just the UFC, his knockdown ratio, 7-4-4 against. For Ryan Spann, 5-4-2 against. But Spann, it seems like in every single one of his fights, he gets cracked and then the wheels completely fall off until he either wins or he loses.
It really is a tale of two different guys, especially with their durability. Because you're right, when Spann gets hurt, he doesn't have the recovery of a guy like Anthony Smith. Smith will get hurt to the body, hurt to the head, kind of do that turtle up. And if he is able to work his way through it, he can still be an effective fighter after those big moments. But you're right, when Spann does get hurt, he doesn't necessarily have that backup kind of generator. Remember Michael Bisping? Like, Michael Bisping's fights didn't start until he got dropped, and then he just became like a superhero afterwards. For Anthony Smith, again, I just wonder, can he still go through those early sets of adversity and find his way out on the other? Because again, at 36-18, like, even the wins have been difficult for Anthony Smith along the way, so you do worry about when age is going to catch up to him. And I know it's 205 in heavyweights, we will see them still be in their prime in their mid to late 30s, but again, for Smith, it comes down a lot more to the damage than even his age on a piece of paper.
And I mentioned it earlier on this card, Parker Porter somehow has the number of both Toffas probably in his, like, his family list, because, like,
do you think they have a group chat?
He's got those guys on speed dial. Anthony Smith and Tim Williams. He had Tim Williams' number. Matt, when you do look at this one, Spann is favored in the rematch. He was favored in the original matchup. We have a look at the Tapology votes. Surprise SDR to you, I don't think the fans are going with Anthony Smith in this one, and I think an inordinate amount are going with Ryan Spann. I'm going to say over under 80% Spann. The fans had Spann over Krylov as well. I think they like Spann in this
I think it's going to be under. I think Anthony Smith is enough of a fan.
And it is. So 822 total votes, 71% Spann, 76% by knockout. For the 29% that I have Smith, 57% see it going by way of submission, as it did in their first meeting. And for Ryan Spann, it's weird. it's really weird because you'll watch him fight and he'll keep his hands really high, and then you hear Coach Saif yell, "Throw a jab!" And I'll throw one jab, and then I'll go back up to the high guard, and there's nothing behind it. He doesn't throw in combination. He'll kind of throw some of those power shots. When the wheels fall off, that's why I said Anthony Smith, once he got out of, or he was able to get rid of the seatbelt grip of Ryan Spann after he got carried across the cage, he turns around and he throws, it's a left hand that wobbles, and then he throws, I think it was a jab, and then he throws a right hand that wobbles, and Spann's not
off. He fight like Alexander Semin. A lot of these going on.
It was a lot of that. And that's the other thing for both of these guys. They kind of play the game of MMA like a Patrick Kane or like a Monte Ellis.
They don't like cab drivers?
They don't play defense. Oh. All they do is play offense. Smith maybe plays defense a little bit more, but Ryan Spann, it tends to be all gas, no brakes. That's overused. He's got that dog in him. That's overused, like you said, for Ryan or Anthony Smith. But when I look at a fight like this, I will go with Ryan Spann. But the other red flag to throw up there is fight against Sam Alvey where his cardio wasn't good. Those things really happen for Ryan Spann.
This is a fight that I think is very close on paper, but the result won't be close in the end.
No.
Like, don't expect a split decision where everybody's divided about it on Twitter, because, again, it's going to either end first round knockout for Spann, because he does have that kind of power if he's able to land consistently. I don't think Anthony Smith, if he does that shell up thing up against the cage, is going to be able to withstand some of the power coming his way if Spann is able to connect. But Smith does throw the higher variety of strikes. The one thing I don't like about this version of Anthony Smith's career, though, is one of his best positions for the longest time was that tie clinch. He had great elbows and great knees up the middle. We have seen guys outwork him in that position is a bit of a stretch, but at least have success there. And I don't know if he's still going to be able to go out there and just blast elbows to the head like he used to be. So for that reason, I agree with you. I do have Ryan Spann in the matchup.
Well, that was going with Superman Ryan Spann. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have. It's time for the main event, the Korean Zombie. 9 straight main events. He's going to be taking on the former champ, Max Blessed Holloway. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
It's the fight on the poster, the main event. Max Holloway taking on the Korean Zombie, Chan Sung Jung. As always, one half your host and duo, Craig Allen. Twitter and Instagram, at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, he's got a haircut. It's at Matt Allen, FNP. Some big time fights on this card, but none bigger than the main event. The former champion, he was interim. He unified it. He got things rolling. One of the best featherweights out there. It is Max Blessed Holloway. Number one all time by a long shot in significant strikes landed in the UFC. And he's taking on a man who's going to be competing in his 10th straight main event in the Korean Zombie in Kallang, Singapore. So Matt, a big time fight between these two guys.
Oh, yeah.
And for the Korean Zombie, we haven't seen him in action since early last year when he took on Alexander Volkanovski, and it certainly wasn't his day. But on Chan Sung Jung's best day, we're throwing hooks to close the distance. He's mixing in his wrestling against Dan Ige to get the title shot. For the Korean Zombie, even go back to his fight against Dennis Bermudez. He gets clocked by the first big overhand right that Bermudez lands.
Is that not one of the dirtiest uppercuts you've ever seen?
Yeah, to rally his way back into it, and he lands the big uppercut. Bermudez is down like a sack of potatoes, and that was off of a really long layoff due to mandatory military service for the Korean Zombie, who hadn't competed since he fought for the title against Jose Aldo. So for the Korean Zombie, he fights Bermudez. That's a performance of the night. He has a fight of the year against Yair Rodriguez, and we've kind of seen what's happened from there in losing to Rodriguez since then. Wins over Renato Moicano, win over Frankie Edgar, the loss against Brian Ortega, the win over Dan Ige. Korean Zombie hasn't taken an easy fight since he's been back, and it's been really, really awesome to see the return for him.
Oh, it has been. Like, the Korean Zombie, you don't go by the Korean Zombie without having an absurd amount of fanfare. When's the last time you heard anybody call him Chan Sung Jung? Because it's been a hot minute. They even have on the broadcast Zombie under him, like, with his color shorts. That's how well-known he is by that nickname and by that moniker.
People haven't been calling me the Prop King of MMA for long. I wish it sticks.
I don't think anybody's calling
me
that.
They're not wearing a t-shirt of me. They're wearing Korean Zombie t-shirts.
This is my thing about the Korean Zombie. Though I was listening to a podcast about the upcoming NFL season, and they said something that really stood out to me, and it made me think about other teams in this light. It was, hey, I forget what team exactly, but they go, they have more players that you know, but does it mean that they're better? Because having a big name and having that notoriety, it kind of depends on what stage of your career you're at, right? And for Chan Sung Jung, I bring up Nomar Garciaparra earlier. I'm worried the Korean Zombie Shaquille O'Neal in a Celtics jersey. Now, he didn't play a lot of games with the Celtics. We did see one, and it was the saddest thing I've ever seen. Rondo's like trying to throw him alley-oops, and if it wasn't perfect, Shaq would just kind of let it go out of bounds and just accept the turnover. And for the Korean Zombie at 36 years old, There could have been a case to be made that he was past his prime when he was 32, just based on the amount of damage that he has taken and the amount of layoffs that he's had, because you bring up the initial one before the Bermudez fight. He tore his ACL after the Bermudez fight and had to take another extended layoff before going into that Yair Rodriguez matchup. I know he looked good against Yair, even though it was a losing effort. He was very close to winning that fight until one of the all-time great knockouts happened. But for the Korean Zombie in his last time out, he had nothing for Alexander Volkanovski. And I know, listen, Volkanovski may have beat Islam Makhachev. That's how good that guy is. But Max Holloway was at least able to stay consistent with him and have a few competitive fights. The third fight wasn't all that close, if we're being honest. But even though I think Max Holloway might not be in his prime anymore, he might not be the guy who fought Brian Ortega and put on one of the all-time great striking clinics, I still think he's closer to it. If he's on the same Shaq timeline, he's probably with the Miami Heat. You know, he could win a title if there's another guy who's a little bit better. I just don't think he's as far past as Chan Sung Jung, because you bring it up. Max Holloway has never been knocked down throughout his UFC tenure. He has one of the all-time great chins. He's one of the most durable fighters we have ever seen. And I do think a lot of that comes down to his cardio and just his level of fitness overall. Holloway has great cardio, great chin, great output. I just don't know, outside of one big punch, how does Chan Sung Jung go out there and win this fight convincingly?
Maybe he decides he wants to wrestle a little bit.
The problem is, though, he's got great grappling. I just don't know if the wrestling's at the level it has to be to go out there and take down Max Holloway over and over.
That's the thing for the Korean Zombie in this one, too. In past fights, he's trained at Korean Zombie MMA. He's trained at Fight Ready MMA for the last number of fights. He was getting ready there for the Volkanovski fight, so Champ Camp with Figueiredo and Cejudo, and the list goes on. And he used to train a little bit at the MMA lab as well. So when it comes down to this one, you look at his Instagram. I thought he had the nicest call out in the entire world.
He seems like a very pleasant man.
In April, he called out Max Holloway. He said, "You want the fight? Let's make the fight." So they did make the fight. But it seems like he's been training in Korea for this one. So I'll be interested to see if his regular striking coach, being Fight Ready's Eddie Cha, makes the trip over to Singapore and he is in the corner. But when you look at a fight like this for Max Holloway, The kind of flip side of the coin is, look at the guys that he's been able to turn away while not beating Alexander Volkanovski. And since 2013, he loses to Conor McGregor, who was on a run. He loses up at lightweight against Dustin Poirier, and he loses three fights against Volkanovski. Other than that, they're all wins. He turns away Yair Rodriguez in one of the most insane fight of the nights that you're going to see.
That fight was that close.
He turned away Arnold Allen his last time out, and that fight wasn't all that close.
But this is what I mean. For Max Holloway, this is why I say I think he's a little bit past his prime. If prime him, I think, would have stopped Yair, and prime him, I think, would have stopped Arnold Allen. I do think these fights against contenders are getting a little bit closer and a little bit closer, because if he fought Yair tomorrow, I don't know who I'd pick. Like, honestly, that's how good I think Yair is. I know he got beat by Volkanovski, too. But I just think for Holloway, yes, he's still got the output. Yes, he still has a lot of high volume. I just don't know if it's at that Hall of Fame tier that it once was. Because you bring up the striking numbers. Max Holloway looks like Wilt Chamberlain when it comes to his significant strike numbers. That's how far ahead he is of the second place. But I still think it's turned down just like a little tick from his absolute prime.
You got to give it to the people. 3,122 significant strikes landed career for Max Holloway in the UFC. Number two all time, Angela Hill, at 1,821. There's a big gap there. There's also a big gap for both of these guys career-wise in the UFC for what they throw per minute. For Max Holloway, 7.16 to 4.79 absorbed per minute, compared to Korean Zombie that has a negative strike differential, 3.97 to 4.37 absorbed. So it is very positive for Holloway. He's shown that positivity and at least the fact that he can go out there and throw those high numbers against Yair Rodriguez, primary striker, MMA math being what it is, and Max Holloway having the wins over Jose Aldo as well. But when you look at it for Holloway doing it against the young up and comer, the heavy hitter, Arnold Allen, and we saw what Arnold Allen was able to do when he fought Calvin Kattar, knee injury notwithstanding, but for Allen, he wasn't able to have that same success against Max Holloway. So when you look at a fight like this, Holloway is definitely not favored to win it. We threw this one out.
Yes, he is.
I said the opposite, and I meant to say it. No. Max Holloway is a giant favorite in the matchup. We threw it out there to you guys on the YouTube channel, and you guys always respond in the community tab. But Matt, almost 1,000 total votes from this morning, 90% going with Max Holloway. Black Panda saying, "Zombie wins easily, mark my words." We've got, if Max is not minus 10,000, something's wrong. Eric is saying, "Why the UFC doing this to Zombie? Give him a favorable stylistic matchup and let the man retire." And I'll go with one more. Justin, this fight makes no sense whatsoever. Justin, there's a few of those on this card. When it does come down to this one, Matt, it pains me to say it.
Everyone loves the Korean Zombie. Everybody who voted for Max Holloway kind of felt bad, right? Because they were like, oh, well, if he wins, That means Chance Sung Jung's gotta lose, and nobody wants that.
We don't come at this from a fan perspective. We try and play it right down the line, respectable, so on and so forth. I bought the shirt years ago, so I figured I'd have it as the big reveal at the end. But I don't have the Korean Zombie in this fight. Unless he shows a new wrinkle. He showed a little bit of that wrestling, the volume, when he took on Dan Ige. He showed it earlier on in his career as well. Everybody remembers, and it's at the forefront of everybody's mind. He loses to Leonard Garcia in a wild fight in their first one. But in the second one, he gets the twister. So Korean Zombie does have that ground game. It's just not a package that we get to see very often. And maybe this is it to save a spot in the top half of this featherweight division. But for me, I think the striking, the volume, and the longevity of Holloway is going to play out in this one.
I've also got Max Holloway in this fight, but I gotta be 100% honest. If he fought Josh Emmett, I think that'd be really interesting. Like, I think there's names at the top of the featherweight division that could have competitive fights with Holloway. We saw that against Yair Rodriguez. That was a really close fight. There were people who genuinely thought Yair won that. Now, I don't agree with them, but still, it was that close of a fight that if you really want to have that argument, I'm not gonna sit here and disagree with you all that wholeheartedly. So, I think for Max Holloway, he has all the skills to win this fight, but I think there is going to come a certain time. I know, what a prediction. Everybody loses, but I think there's gonna be a certain time, probably sooner rather than later, where we will see one of these prospects making their way up the division actually dethrone the number one contender, because that's been the thing for Max Holloway. He's kind of been in that, like, remember when Colby Covington was just the number one contender for Usman for basically 3 straight years? That's what Holloway is for Volkanovski.
That man is Ilia Topuria, and he's coming. Matt, a big time fight in this main event. Both of us going with Max Holloway to get the win. A lot of prospects on the card. A lot of stuff to look forward to. This card is also, don't forget, in Singapore. So it's a really early show on Saturday morning when the UFC decide to go live. And we'll have an abbreviated question mark kicks that most likely won't be 2 hours before the prelims. Because the last time I checked, they start at like 5 a.m. Eastern. So look out for a special edition of question mark kicks when that drops here on the channel. If you're not already subscribed, hit that button, toss a like on the way out. Putting the shows together, some big time fights this week. You're not going to want to miss any of it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.